Well, hello everyone, and welcome to another Deepest Lore. We're reviewing Adam Curtis for the 48th time. It's a bloody hot day, and we are, for the final time, going to be reviewing Bitter Lake. How are you doing today, Simon? I've got my phone on in the background.
I know, I'm very distressed. My posh Lakeland butter dish, which was keeping butter at an optimal temperature out of the fridge, has failed me, and the butter is now the consistency of custard.
Now, if you leave it and it becomes a cold day again,
yeah,
that butter will kind of go hard again, but it will be rancid.
Yeah, thanks. Okay. Yeah, because it was at the perfect spreading temperature before, sort of still had a creamy thickness about it, but it didn't tear the bread, you know. But now it's just slush.
Horace, I did this week, sir.
Good afternoon, chaps. Yeah, I'm doing all right. I'm a bit kind of horrified by the state of the world. Seems to be a particularly horrible week for various events, but yeah, I'm doing okay. I'm bearing up, you know. How are you?
Oh,
AA, we can't hear you. AA, we still can't hear you.
The dodgy Wi-Fi signal about which we were speaking before the stream.
There was a little sort of breaking in his voice a moment ago, wasn't there?
They got him.
Sorry, guys. My internet is bad at the minute, so I keep on cutting out. I don't know what to do about it.
So we could be going for more continuation streams.
Lucky hell. Well, I've got almost no signal. It's usually like full, but it's like on one today, and it was bad yesterday as well. I cut out during my stream yesterday,
just when everything was going so well with the world, you know.
Well, I know. I've been gardening this week, mainly. I've got a compost bin, and I've been composting, weeding, and getting things in order. And I kind of enjoyed it more than I thought I would. Maybe this is what happens when you reach your 40s.
You were napalming the sow thistle or something.
I hate sow thistle, yeah.
You had a combination of chemicals that were quite comprehensive.
What I did is that I kind of cheated a bit, because where the lot in the park where the lodge is, there are staff and things. So I enlisted their aid to do the actual weed killing part. So I wouldn't have to buy weed killer or get my delicate hands involved, because that stuff is toxic if it goes on you, you know?
Yeah. And buying large quantities of chemicals at the moment is probably something to get someone else to do.
Yeah, no, like they've got, like they wear the big masks, and they've got this kind of long hose thing. I was like, well, you guys can do that. I just did. I cut a bramble out, and brambles are an absolute pain in the ass, I'll tell you that much.
You're feeling as I did actually, with the world news and with your weeds. We're all feeling Douglas Murray's sense of existential tiredness this week.
One thing the hot sunny weather is great for my plants. I keep a collection of plants in the house, and they're growing, they're vibrant, they're full of life.
I'm glad somebody is. I'm glad somebody is. I'll also say that I've got a new pet peeve, right? I have need occasionally to use the services of, let's just say, a whole cottage industry that exists on a website called Etsy. Are you familiar with this website?
Yeah. It's quite good now.
So I fairly regularly get packages from Etsy. Now, I've got two little issues with this. One is that some of the items that I receive from Etsy, I don't really want anybody else to know what they are. And it's a little bit annoying when the sellers on Etsy basically plaster the box with what it is.
Yeah.
Which creates an issue because it's like, the missus has got this saying, no cats, no bags, i.e. I can never get away with any secrets whatsoever. Yeah. It has a way of finding out. And when I came home yesterday, she was like, oh, I wonder what that is. All over the outside. So that's the first thing. And then the second thing is that they're very, very, very overzealous with the packaging. I know like items are, you know, that can get damaged in the post and so on. But like when you've got something that is literally triple boxed, and then it takes you about 20 minutes to cut through all the cardboard and the various different layers that they've got. And then when you make it, there are those big thick bits of polystyrene that go everywhere.
Oh, yeah.
And there is yet more tape, and then it's tape within the tape. It took me literally about 40 minutes to open a package earlier on. It's too long, mate.
It's like an autopsy, isn't it? You've got a waste disposal problem.
Yes. Well, I've dealt with all of that. But yes, it is a waste disposal issue as well, because they've put so much tape and so much polystyrene, and it's intimately connected with the cardboard, so you can't really separate out the cardboard. So I just put it in the regular big bin outside. You know, I put the whole thing in the normal trash, because there's no way I'm sifting out the sellotape and the cardboard and the polystyrene and the various layers of bullshit I had to get through to open this package. So,
helps get past the sniffer dogs, doesn't it? So,
well, I'm not buying anything like that for us. I'm afraid, nothing so exciting, sadly.
Just your large collection of Funko Pops that you've been ordering in. Thomas Carlyle Funko Pops.
Okay. Anything else you want to discuss before we get going here?
Just the world in general. I mean, this thing with Trump. I was watching Judge Knapp last night, and it was the Jeffrey Sachs, discussing about Trump. Ironically, with this film in Saudi Arabia the other week, talking about the West going into countries they really don't understand. And I just somewhat despaired at that point. And it's the only time I've seen Judge Knapp get vaguely excited. He raised his voice. I don't know if it's a wig. I mean, I think it's his natural hair, but it does look somewhat dyed. It rose visibly with his agitation.
Well, I mean, it's also keeping me up, because last night the Ayatollah was like, Iran is going to show the world something tonight that will be remembered for centuries. Fucking nothing happened.
What was it?
I don't know. I still don't know. I mean, I don't know if Israel are kind of doing like a blackout thing where they're not letting any videos out at the moment. But if it's something we're going to remember for centuries, I don't even know what it was. So that was a massive nothing burger. And then... and then Trump also is like, he's moved all the troops into place, all of the big talk, but still nothing happens. Yeah. I thought they would have. I made a video yesterday where I was like expecting America to have gone in already. Still hasn't happened. So I don't know. There's a lot of, for some reason, with these powers in particular, with the Ayatollah and with Trump, there's a lot of nothing ever happens, despite the fact that massive things are happening, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, or maximalist confusion, in this sense I've been alluding to various times, that is very Vlad Surkov, that you get into in the next documentary, Hypernormalization. And Trump is this also a great exponent of this. And I was wanting to play, if I can, this little clip of an interview that Adam Curtis did in the last week talking about this peculiarity of Trump. It's about 4.5 minutes long, and I'll just let it run and see what you think. It's by a Scottish comedian called Mark Jennings, who has got a podcast called Some Laugh. And Curtis was on talking about, initially talking about Ayn Rand and the problem of individualism. And he gets on to politicians, and here's what he has to say.
I think Trump is different, though, to be honest. I think the really interesting thing about people like Ayn Rand is they got
Simon, I think you going on mute maybe made it stop.
Oh, sorry.
we got as far as the difference with Trump. Try again.
Hold on.
I thought it was me.
Let's wheel it back a bit. Hold on.
Let's start again. Start the whole thing again.
I think it was when you went on mute.
Yeah, inadvertently.
He forgot he was on playing it through his speaker.
Yes. Okay, here we go. I'll try this again. Right.
Not being bad, but being self-interested was the right thing. It was the motor for our society. And that was very strong in Silicon Valley. When I made that film, I had learned quite early on that all the people in Silicon Valley were obsessed by Ayn Rand. And I went and interviewed them because it fitted with their idea of everyone on social media talking to each other as self-interested individuals. But what it got into that water was the idea that self-interest was good. Then what happened was you got politicians who were completely unable to cope with that. You see it really after the collapse of the global crash in 2008. What then emerges are these strange politicians like Johnson, like Donald Trump, who actually, I would say, cosplay badness. That in an age of disenchantment with politicians, where you don't trust politicians any longer, which by 2008, that's what we felt. We didn't trust them. If you have this disenchantment and you have distrust, what is the only authentic thing a politician can do? Be bad. Because that somehow is authentic, right, in people's view. He's being true to himself. And remember, that's what people liked about Johnson. They knew he was bad, but as opposed to the phonies, he was being himself. That was his trick. And the same thing's true with Trump, is we know he's bad, and he knows that we know he's bad. And he plays to that very strongly. But somehow there is this strange sense that, oh, that must mean he's being true to himself, as opposed to all these phonies like Hillary Clinton and Bill Clinton, which you and I would probably agree with. They were phonies. They were trying to hold on to power without knowing really what to do. So they sort of present themselves as a sort of a fake authenticity of badness. I know that sounds a bit weird, but it's sort of where we've got to. I don't quite know what Keir Starmer presents himself as. That's still a mystery. I don't know quite what he is cosplaying. Because yeah. The really interesting thing about our time are the people who are trusted are the ones who create a character that we suspect is as close to what they are really like. So Ricky Gervais did it very well in The Office. He created a character which we know is a pantomime figure, but we also suspected that he was like that. And he knew that we suspect. So it's this idea of a sort of... Jeremy Clarkson is another one. You know it's a pantomime character, and you know he's very clever, but you suspect he's also a bit like that as well. And he plays to that to us, as opposed to the Hillary Clintons, the Tony Blairs, who just hide it all.
Well, it's like in wrestling, they've got that term kayfabe.
Kayfabe,
and it's like, and now that's totally broken because we've got social media and we've got, and you can see that they're doing strategies and all the rest of it. And like, you just know it's all fake.
I've always wanted to make a film about kayfabe. And Japanese wrestling and how it spread out from it.
Adam, wait, stop!
It was ever since
there's some, I can't remember the name of the wrestler here. There's some big wrestler here who named one of his signal move hypernormalization because he liked my film. So I thought,
brilliant.
Okay. I started reading about wrestling and learned about kayfabe. Because, but kayfabe's got very interesting now. It sort of was revealed towards the end of the 90s. What they then did was they then started playing this game, the wrestling fraternity, of saying, okay, we know that you know that we're making it up, but actually behind that there is a real story. And they then invented another hidden story. So by the early part of the 2000s, there were these really complex levels of fakeness going on within the wrestling fraternity and kayfabe. There's a sort of dark comedy in there somewhere.
And I think that sounds really similar to where we're at with politics as well, because it's like back when it was the 90s and Blair and all that, they could sort of, when everyone got it through telly, they could sort of live up to it. But now, you know, the kayfabe's broke.
You have no idea what you're, yeah that's right. The kayfabe's broke.
There you go.
I've got to dispute one thing that he said there, that in the late 90s, kayfabe sort of fell apart. I'm sure people knew. I'm sure people knew before the late 90s.
Well, you know, the pro wrestling was...
yeah.
I mean, technically speaking, Vince McMahon broke kayfabe in the early 80s. Well, two reasons, really. One is that he basically admitted in court wrestling was fake. Up until then, when they put events on at Madison Square Garden and Boston Gardens and so on, the referees were provided by the State Athletic Commission. And Vince didn't want the referee. He wanted the referees to be under WWF payroll. And he didn't want to have to be under the rules of the State Athletic Commission. So he basically said, well, listen, wrestling's not a sport, so fuck off with the State Athletic. Right. So he broke a lot of things like that legally in the 80s. And he moved the product towards basically selling action figures to kids, you know, Hulk Hogan and, you know...
Great Valentine, I had.
You know, Coco Beware, the Birdman and so on. It's like, well, this is he changed wrestling quite a bit from where it had been, you know, Dory Funk Jr. against Jeff Briscoe. And, you know, the commentator being the old Gordon Solie, you know, are two athletic young men, you know, both great amateur backgrounds and all this sort of stuff. And Vince was like, yeah, here's a dude from the swamp. His name's Skinner. Right. Yeah. So he's a very different type of presentation from what wrestling had been. So, but by the late 90s, it was truly, well and truly. So anyway, I shouted out Adam because maybe he should consult me on that documentary.
Absolutely should.
The only person I reckon in the world who has watched every single Adam Curtis documentary and has a deep knowledge of Japanese AJ wrestling from the late 80s.
Yeah. He's going to be texting you after the show. He'll be interviewing you in a ruined office somewhere.
Yes.
Or something, or a wrestling ring.
He could interview me outside the lodge, sitting in a pile of weeds. How about that?
There you go. Yeah, I mean, it's in a way a kind of facile thing that, you know, I'm clinging on to it, you know, because of how depressing the last few days have been with Trump. But it's a sort of facile reading in a way that, yes, Trump is just doing this performatively erratic, he's our guy one day, he's not our guy the next day thing. But it's interesting that Curtis feels that that's still the mode that he's in. And I mean, it's going to be tricky to see how he cooks out of this one and becomes our guy again.
I don't think that's
never was.
I think he's gone all in. I mean, half of my timeline is defending Ted Cruz this morning. You know what I mean?
We're in a dark place.
I should also mention, you mentioned Greg the Hammer Valentine there, Horace, right? There was a wrestler known as Chief J Strongbow, who I absolutely hated. A lot of people liked him. He was basically a Red Indian, a Native American. He wasn't actually. He was actually Italian, but he claimed to be. You know, he wore the feathers and he did like the dance and so on. And there was also one called Wahoo McDaniel, who was also, he was actually a Native American, former football star. And Greg Valentine broke, like he ran this angle where he broke Wahoo's leg, right? He put it, like put his leg in the figure four leg lock and broke his leg, right? Injuring and putting Wahoo McDaniel out. And then he wore a t-shirt saying, "I broke Wahoo's leg." But then years later, they ran the exact same angle with Chief J Strongbow in New York. And he broke Chief J Strongbow's leg. So I've always kind of got a kick out of the idea that Greg Valentine was like a secret anti-Red Indian racist. He just broke the leg of Indians, fake or real. You know, so.
He's Greg the Hammer, but he's the hammer of the natives, like Edward the First. Like.
Yes, absolutely, and I should also mention, remember when I did the revamp? Like last year, was it last year? Yeah, I think it was last year.
Yeah,
I did the revamp of the channel, and I said, well, I took inspiration from Greg the Hammer Valentine's father, Johnny Valentine, who had a very slow and methodical pace. And he worked in a territory called Mid-Atlantic, which was actually where Ric Flair made his name as well, the Jim Crockett territory, Jim Crockett Promotions. And they had always been a very fast, kind of high work rate territory where they were used to fast-paced matches. And Johnny Valentine, Greg's father, was slow. You know, like Greg Valentine was slow and methodical. Yeah. And, you know, Gorilla would always say, oh, it takes him 15 minutes to warm up. Well, I mean, Johnny Valentine would literally have like hour-long matches where he'd be like sitting in a headlock for 20 minutes and, you know, he'd just be really slow wrestler.
Right.
And basically, like when they brought in Johnny Valentine as the big heel in the area, the fans were absolutely hating this. Absolutely hated like the change. And Johnny was like, yeah, just give them 6 months. They need to learn. Right. So he did. They basically retrained the entire Mid-Atlantic audience to get into Johnny Valentine's style. And, you know, after about a year or something, he was a massive star. They loved it. You know, they loved watching his matches and so on. But they completely had to retrain them. And I took inspiration from that for my revamp. So, you understand what I'm saying, right? Like, just, well, look, if you just keep on putting it in front of them, you know, night in, night out, Johnny Valentine, headlock, you know, big clubbing blows. They learned, they relearned. And this is kind of what I've done.
Did he continue as a heel?
Yeah, he did, yeah. And in fact, he had a very high-drawing run. I'm trying to remember who the opponent for him now was, but they had a tragic plane accident. And I believe Johnny Valentine was either like crippled or died or something in that plane accident. And a young Ric Flair was on that, I think, in the same journey. And he hurt his back. Ric Flair still, even now, but all the way through his career, had a bad back due to the injury from that. But he didn't die, obviously. But I think Johnny Valentine died in a plane crash in 1975. Anyway. So let us get on to Adam Curtis. Adam, if you ever watch this, I'm your man. I know all about you, but also I know even more about pro wrestling. So I could help him so much. You know.
It's got to happen.
All right. Try to remember who the opponent for Johnny. Who was Johnny Valentine's opponent?
I'm aware that Simon may have been trying to make a different point with the Curtis clip, and I just made it all about wrestling. But...
Yeah, no, sorry about that.
No, it's another great digression. It was funny because when I was talking about that Afghan singer last week, Ahmad Zaheer, you know, he did the song with the famous clip of the bird and the soldier, you know, I looked up a bit more about him, and, you know, we had that massive digression last week. But if I found this page. There was a singer in Tajikistan called Sadruddin Najmuddin. He said that Ahmad Zaheer is as well known as Coca-Cola and possesses a star power akin to that of Michael Jackson. I thought brilliant tie-in to our digressions last week.
The opponent was Wahoo McDaniel, who I mentioned So we made, that's why Greg Valentine broke his leg, as kind of revenge for the father type thing. So anyway, let's go for Bitter Lake. Come on. Oh, hold on a second. What about the summer sale? The summer sale. I mean, it is absolutely boiling. I've got my fan on because it is truly a scorcher. It's the Academic Agency Summer Sale. Use the promo code SCORCHER. 25% off all courses. SCORCHER. Get it now. SCORCHER. 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 Promo code SCORCHER. 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 Buy it now. Gotcha. That divides people. It's some people's absolutely favorite ad. Other people, you know, prefer Mandy, you know, admire so much Mandy one.
I like the rhetoric advert, actually. I think that's really good.
Do you?
Yeah, yeah.
But what about the, I mean, there's been some over the years. What about, you know, merit?
Merit, pure merit, such merit.
There's that. There was Sure Jan, of course, my January sale one.
Sure, 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 and so sure.
Sure Jan.
Can you come? There was Mario Lord. Do you remember that?
Super Mario Brothers.
Game Watch. Game Watch.
Oh, no, this was one of the least popular ones ever.
Mate. Oh, mate.
Capitalism ho.
My gosh. But I don't know. For me, I like Mandy. I like the Mandy one, personally. So,
yeah.
You know, I can't find, where was, I had a Vax Glide 2 one. Do you remember that?
Oh,
that was Jordan
very brief-lived.
The Jordan Peterson one, he says merit too much. It gets a bit repetitive. I like the ones where you do the bombastic voice. I think they're funny. Like,
this is the thing, though, Horace, right? I learned from the best. I learned from mid-century Germans. Repeat. Right. Repeat it every day. Simplify. Yeah. Repeat it. Repeat.
It's one of those urban myth advertising nostrums. You have to sort of repeat it 7 times or something like that, some random number, to embed a message into people when you're giving a.
I worked in marketing, and yeah, there was a lot of stuff to that effect. Like, don't feel that you're annoying people by keeping repeating stuff. Just do it anyway.
Yeah, I think it's something to do with human memory function or something. You know, that you can only keep like 8 things in memory at once, so you fill it with 7 of.
I guarantee you that my ads stick in the mind. People remember the promo code. You'll never forget the promo codes. No. Apart from maybe Vaxblade 2. I can't even find it. It's not even on it.
Master of hard sell.
Anyway, buy a course.
In my direction, elements of the 82nd Airborne Division, as well as key units of the United States Air Force, are arriving today to take up defensive positions in Saudi Arabia. I took this action to assist the Saudi Arabian government in the defense of its homeland.
Osama bin Laden had returned from Afghanistan, and he went to see the Saudi defense minister and pleaded with him not to let the Americans come. He offered to raise a force of Mujahideen fighters in Afghanistan and bring them to defend Saudi Arabia instead. But the defense minister turned him down. And within weeks, over 500,000 American soldiers had arrived in Saudi Arabia. Bin Laden saw it as the corrupt takeover by the West of the very heart of Islam.
Cameraman, please show them what's going on if you could. Show the street of nothing else.
And he decided that America, although it had been his ally in Afghanistan, was the real enemy.
Show him the sky, if you could.
Okay, right.
Wait, what strange noise is that? What?
This is the uncut version Simon made me get.
It is. Although I don't think we're going to get ITV making any copyright claims today.
Well, ITV released every single carry-on copyright on my thing when I did it before. So
there you go.
Is this on my Magnum Opus carry-on making of thing?
Is this carrying up the Khyber?
Yeah, a bit of light mockery of British military adventurism.
Trickery is this. What is this noise? Can you see what is happening?
Oh, yes. They are sitting down to dinner.
Sitting down to dinner? Are they stark, raving bonkers?
I went to that conference last week. There was a guy there who was a spitting image of Bernard Breslau. And one of the papers was really dull.
Mm.
So I spent like half an hour thinking, like, shall I go up and tell him? He looks just like Bernard Breslau.
Oh, I get it all the time, mate.
Breslau on the right.
He was American. Yeah. I think he was American, so he may not have got the reference. But
yeah,
I decided against saying it to him. But I did spend half an hour thinking about saying it's ridiculous how much you look like Bernard Breslau. He was a big guy as well. Big
yeah,
guy.
Like Breslau was, yeah. That's Breslau down on the right there. One of the more lovable of the carry-on character actors, I find.
Just while we're on a pause, are you fans of The Man Who Would Be King?
I have to confess I've not seen it, which is, I know, heresy in these circles.
I didn't know it was that popular. Bo from The Lotus Eaters, he absolutely loves it. He even wrote his own novel based on it. It's like one of his favourite films. And so
is that the Michael Caine movie?
Sean Connery.
Oh, it's good. Yeah, it is good. That is a good movie. Yeah.
Yeah.
I like it. Yeah.
It's set in the same area, isn't it?
Yeah, I like it. There's a good number of those sorts of British Empire type movies that they made back when we had a film industry, you know, in the 60s and 70s. So.
Indeed.
People sometimes infuriate me. Oh, they come out here with their starched uniforms and their stiff upper lips and their dirty great flags hanging out. Think they own the place.
They do.
Well, they won't much longer. Start the attack. By the time I've finished with them, their stiff upper lips will be so limp they'll be hanging down to their navels.
I will kill the pigs. Fire!
There's a fucking target! There's a fucking target in the Kaiser!
Wait!
I'm not denying that I'm not a mullah. I'm a mullah in a mosque, not with the Taliban.
Right, yeah.
So, I mean, they arrested me and they brought me here.
Did he say they beat him?
Beat him and electrification.
Signed false confession? Does he say they forced him to sign a confession?
Oh, no, he didn't say that. Okay. I'll tell you that. They forced me, they beat me, and they put my stamp as saying that you are a Talib.
Does he know, to be honest, really, does he know, are there lots of Taliban here?
Majbur makalafat ke mardam az dawlatam judai kar. Well, I mean, as I told you before, it's 90% of the people who are here, they came by the name of Taliban here, but they are not actually Taliban. They arrest them and they brought them here.
Pause, please. Just wanted to ask, what is a mullah? Is that the same as an imam or what?
It's just what they call the cleric class, I believe.
Okay. Just sort of regional name.
It's like a collective name for the priests.
And while we're doing it, what is an ayatollah?
The ayatollah is the Shia equivalent, the grand ayatollah. is the Shiite equivalent of the Pope.
Ah, and there's no equivalent to that in Sunni Islam, is that right?
That's right.
Right.
But okay. in Shia Islam, he's the head of the religion, like the Pope. There is also Ayatollahs, who are, I guess, the equivalent of cardinals.
All right. And they are in Iran. Iran is considered like the sort of leading Shiite regime, right?
Iran is the center of Shiite Islam, yes.
Okay. Okay.
And there is, if you get into it, it's something to do with 12. There are 12. I always forget now, but there are 12 followers or 12 sons of Muhammad or something.
Yeah.
And the Shia branch is from a guy called Ali.
Yeah.
Prophet Ali, right? And in theory, the Ayatollah and the Mullahs and all of the high ranking Ayatollahs are in some way related to Ali, and they claim lineage from Ali. Yeah.
So it's actually blood lineage as well. Okay.
I believe so. Correct me if I'm wrong, but
I knew that, like, in Sunni Islam, obviously there can be a caliph of the whole Islamic world, but he's supposed to be descended of Muhammad. Right? But in fact, that may be falsified, and there isn't a caliph at the moment, right? There is no caliph of the whole Sunni world. Anyway, that's a different topic.
Yeah. Yes, there's also, you know, when you see them wearing the various different turbans, the color of the turban means something. If it's black, they're like in that kind of blood relation with Ali or something. Whereas if they're white, they're kind of lower down. I don't quite understand it all, but it also signifies the color, whether it's black or white, means something. There's also the current Ayatollah, the one in the news at the minute, Khamenei. There's a lot of question marks about him actually becoming the Grand Ayatollah, because he was not high ranking. Right, it'd be the equivalent of, it's usually like leading candidates to become the Pope when they're like senior cardinals in the Vatican. Yeah. Khamenei was not a leading contender. He was not like a leading Ayatollah. He was more of a political guy in the revolution. But yeah, he was the one who became the Grand Ayatollah. And there are still question marks as to how the hell that happened. And it's a long-standing conspiracy theory within Iran that he was installed by the KGB, or he has ties, because he studied in Moscow and he has ties to Russia. So.
Incidentally, did either of you see there was sort of a rumor going around last night that Ahmadinejad had been assassinated?
What, the old president?
Yeah. It was just a sort of a few accounts, you know, the usual, you know, no kind of source, proper sources, but, you know, reports unconfirmed. He's been shot on the streets of Tehran with his wife and his sons.
Oh, yeah, right. I'm seeing it now.
I'm sure Israel and co. would love to take him out if they could, because they used to cite him as the proof that Iran wants to obliterate Israel.
I would actually suggest that it's possible that would be an inside job on him, because he's a bit of a pain in the ass for the regime. Yeah. When they put him in as a kind of populist concession. But then they stopped him running again, and they basically, like, he's almost been like Jeremy Corbyn, if that makes any sense, or like he's been sidelined within Iranian politics. So yeah. I wouldn't be surprised if it was the Ayatollahs themselves. And you know, I was speaking about the turbans. It was significant that he didn't wear one, for example.
Yeah, he looked secular.
And he was more of a populist nationalist kind of figure, and a bit of an edgelord, as everybody knows. Also a pain for the regime.
One of the kind of Che Guevara's of the revolution. I saw he was connected with the taking of the hostages in Tehran back in 1979, 1980? The American hostages? Yeah.
Oh, into 80 as well, right.
So. Yeah.
there's that film about it, isn't there? So just to tie back to my question. So that guy just we saw just then was a mullah, and that is but that's like more of a cultural word, I assume, because Afghanistan is mostly Sunni, right? I believe.
I'm assuming it's a word a bit like sheikh in a way. It gets applied as a kind of word for leader, right. You know, sort of more generally rather than it being a kind of specific rank.
But it's religious, whereas sheikh is more
secular,
I think.
I mean, I don't know. I mean, maybe it's more formal but the way that I've heard Iranians use it, it's usually as a collective, as we'd say, the clergy or
the mullahs,
the priests, you know. Mm. It refers to them as a class, and then within that they've got obviously titles and ranks and so on and so forth. So
when the Russians left Afghanistan, the different mujahideen groups turned on each other and began a vicious struggle for power. Kabul was completely destroyed as the different groups fired thousands of rockets indiscriminately into the heart of the city. And Kabul became a living hell. Mujahideen leaders transformed. They became brutal warlords, tearing the country apart. The Americans had stopped sending any money or arms, so to fund themselves, the warlords turned to the heroin trade, and they began to export more and more opium to the West. The poppy fields of Helmand became the center of a multi-million dollar business, irrigated by the dams and canals built 40 years before by the American government. Out of the chaos came two extreme and violent reactions. Both ruthlessly simplified the world, and both, although they were completely contradictory, were rooted in Wahhabism, the intolerant fundamentalism that came from Saudi Arabia. One was the Taliban. They started as a group of students in religious schools in Pakistan called madrasas.
Of course, in the West, they call that autism.
So what people do at the Wailing Wall as well, isn't it? Like nodding your head forward as you pray. That's a Jewish thing as well.
They became the core of a revolution that spread rapidly through Afghanistan.
Hello? Hello? Single de Morana. Zamunga Samadri, Salam of Pari Fazat Kusata, Delta, the Darlum Talibandi, the Sultan is about Gazi, the hand that I miss the shame, the hand that I remember fully in the government.
The enemy Kitabuna was a use with Talibuka, and the hand of Inshallah in your passage.
Sabakta, the Swako, and the study where I was a
policy. The study when you walk in the Vigax, the study recording the hand of Inshallah.
Although they were in Pakistan, most of the madrasas had been created over the previous 20 years by money from Saudi Arabia. They were part of the massive effort.
Of course, they didn't mention that they were still studying barbering. Simon, for their future exploits, running barbershops all over the UK.
Great, great scene there showing that students lie to their tutors, just as we do in the West.
It had been started by King Faisal to spread fundamentalism throughout the Islamic world. And the ideas that the madrasas taught were very close to Saudi Wahhabism. When the Taliban swept into Kabul, they went to the presidential palace and tore out all painted images of living things, even removing the faces off the stone lions. The society the Taliban built was based on an imagined idea of the past, a recreation of how they thought Islamic society had been run in the 7th century. All modernization was swept away. Women were not to be educated, and all film and music was banned.
Pause, please. What are we listening to? What music have we got on here, Simon? Is this Aphex Twin?
Ooh, don't know what that bit was. The bit that was playing before was a bit from Carpenter's The Fog. So I don't know if that's continued on here. I wasn't paying attention, but that's what's in my notes at roughly this point.
I think several times I've stopped and asked if it's Aphex Twin. It never is. He does use Aphex Twin, doesn't he?
I've seen other people refer to Aphex Twin. I think it's very rare, actually, he's used Aphex Twin.
Okay.
I don't recall it coming up that often. Yeah.
Aphex Twin's ambient work, too, is very, very ambient. It's like quite formless.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. Skinny Puppy is the one that the guy on the Loving Trap parody reckons he uses, but I don't think he ever uses Skinny Puppy either.
He got big into Burial around, I don't know, 2010
this point,
or something.
Yeah, roughly here. Yeah,
it's not part of you, because the kind of scientific or political scientist part of my brain, or the sociology, anthropology, whatever you call it, are you not interested to see what may have come of their efforts? Like, I called the stream, "What Was the West Fighting For in Afghanistan?" I kind of wish they just let it run, see what happens. It's kind of interesting, isn't it? Let it go.
Yeah.
And even the bodies of dead communists were dug up and burnt to cleanse and purify the land. The other reaction came from Osama bin Laden. Bin Laden had come back to Afghanistan, determined to lead an Islamist revolution. But his ideas were very different from the Taliban. He wanted to use Islamic principles in a new way, to make it a revolutionary force in the modern world. To go forwards, not backwards. But the problem was,
so he's kind of like, it's the split between the reactionaries and the futurists. Again, it's like the Evelers and the kind of.
Anglo futurism now, I suppose, is one example. But yeah, people who take a sympathetic view of progress, if you like, modernity, technology, and a desire to combine that with a sort of theological rigor, but one that's sufficiently elastic to allow the country to develop.
Someone in the chat is saying not interfering is how you get a rival castle, but like, with respect, they're going back to the 7th century. It's like, they're probably not going to be that much of a threat. Just leave them be. What are they going to do? Like, throw rocks at you? And yeah. I mean, let's not forget, they still took the L to the Taliban for reasons that still remain mysterious, but the current attack on Iran may be one of them, because a lot of the infiltration was actually through the Afghan network. So my dad told me, 50 million Afghans ended up in Iran, and they have been used for Mossad subversion since. So maybe that's why they kind of gave that and those weapons that were left in Afghanistan have ended up somehow in the hands of people who are against Iran. So,
did you say 15 million Afghans live in Iran?
They've ended up in Iran after the shenanigans. And yeah,
suddenly I feel a lot more sorry for Iran.
Yeah, hell of a refugee crisis. And of course, this is why my dad cusses out the mullahs so much. They've got this idea of Islamic brotherhood that literally nobody else shares, you know, so it's just absolute bullshit.
What is the cost of that to Afghan women and children? Iranian women and children.
Oh, it's just insane. It's just like, and you know, from their point of view, you know, they're, all their taxes are going on, like, funding Hezbollah and stuff like this, you know. So it's kind of, anyway, let's carry on.
That these ideas had failed to capture the public imagination, not just in Afghanistan, but throughout most of the Islamic world. Bin Laden was convinced that what was stopping this revolution was America. He had seen how American money had corrupted Saudi Arabia. Now he believed that America was corrupting the minds of Muslim people everywhere and preventing them from rising up and liberating themselves. Bin Laden's Islamist ideas began to mutate and become mixed with the intolerant and anti-modern anger of Wahhabism. Out of it came a dark and apocalyptic jihadism. It's said that the only way to create a revolution would be to attack what he called the far enemy directly. The dramatic shock would somehow liberate the masses. But all discussion of what kind of society would result dropped away and was replaced by a stark vision of the coming battle between good and evil.
Is this from a movie, Simon?
No, I think this is just raw footage. I think it's Curtis is using this to, again, you know, reiterate this idea of sort of some sort of force is being almost summoned out of the landscape.
Sorry, I've got to ask, why was that guy shot in the bum and then suddenly dragged off screen?
Couldn't track it down. I think the closest I could find, he might have been a Pakistani cameraman. He was just shot through the pelvis there. God. Don't know much more about it.
Curtis just loves a shot of a bloody body lying on the
dramatically
ground.
Wounded person.
Just loves it.
Suddenly dragged off screen.
Yeah.
No cheers for anyone?
I'm not keen on this guy. I'm not going to cheer for him.
What was going on there?
Again, really couldn't track it. There's so many bits of footage here that I tried sort of reverse image searching. I think it's a fight going on in the Russian parliament, which, you know, from the sort of early 90s. But I don't know who the characters are. I couldn't track anyone down.
In the chat, can we get a big S for the amount of effort that Simon puts into this? He tries to track down virtually every shot in the whole documentary and all the music. It's fucking
brilliant. Well, like I said, it's difficult with this one because so much of it was just footage that was lying in the BBC's filing cabinets in Kabul for years and years without really, you know, it's not logged anywhere for us to sort of find out. So the only bits you can find online that match the images are the bits that come from this documentary, which is a shame.
Curtis here, Simon.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah.
This is Pete Curtis right here.
She reminds me of something from Return of the Jedi in Jabba's yes. You know, one of the dancing girls.
Yeah.
Tony Blair is a slightly bewildered figure there.
What song is this, Simon?
This is Electronic Rhythm Number 3 by Pi Corner Audio.
Tony Blair, Tony Blair, Tony. they're chanting it. They love him there. Oh, let's get into it.
I wonder if he replays that moment in his mind at times.
That was an exquisite Curtis sequence, that one.
Yeah.
I have to try to cut it out and stick it on Twitter.
Don't you find it interesting, though, seeing these past images of Blair where he's fresher faced and you almost think he looks kind of naive in a way?
Gives me a little bit of nostalgia from that because we were young then as well.
Yeah.
I do feel that these were his apprentice years and he has since become the Dark Lord. You know, that these were his Darth Maul years and now he's, or his young, you know, I don't know who his Darth Plagueis was, but at some point, maybe Kissinger, I don't know.
Simon, in relation to me asking for the chat to approve of your level of research, Seamus O'Blaine in the chat says, does Simon have an OF?
What an OnlyFans.
I think it just means a payment option, you know. Just
Right. Oh, okay. Not at present, but thank you very much for anybody who's...
There is a kind of Simon Roberts OnlyFans, and it's Port Film Co-op on Entropy asking Simon Accent Challenge, Mark Levin eating his own head, no actual words, just sounds.
He's horrible, Mark Levin. I always remember, you know, I used to listen to Mark Stein as distinct from Mark Levin about 7-8 years ago. Mark Stein was always very funny. He used to sit in for Rush Limbaugh.
Yeah, and he's dry.
Huh?
He's dry, isn't he? He's good.
He used to do these very funny monologues. I remember there was one time, the classic one he did was when Hillary was talking about disinformation at one stage and she talked about, you know, content being created in Macedonia. And Mark did this brilliant monologue about Macedonian content farmers. You know, he talked about the Macedonian content farmers sitting on their porch, strumming the gadulka, singing the ancient content farming songs of their ancestors. And it was always sort of Stuart Lee-ish. But Mark Levin used to come up in my sort of suggestions, like on YouTube. And I tried looking at him once or twice, and he was just really unlikable.
Yeah.
I never understood people.
I mean, Mark Levin is currently engaged in the worst propaganda campaign I have ever, and I mean ever, witnessed. He is he is so bad at his job. It's your only job, Mark, and he's bad at it. I'm just saying. He is. It is whatever the opposite of persuasion is, it's whatever Mark Levin is doing at the minute.
Yeah, apparently he's got direct access to the president for some reason.
It's absolutely bizarre. Absolutely ridiculous. I mean, shall I read some of his recent tweets? AOC is David Duke in a dress.
She's just not. That's just not true.
What else? I will be on Hannity tonight on Fox. Hold on a second. I mean, the whole gambit now is to claim that he is the real MAGA and that Tucker and anybody who's against this war are fake MAGA, or that they're, you know...
Yeah, Qatar MAGA.
Currently, was he a never-Trumper back in the day?
Yeah, he said he'd never... Yeah.
So he's just improvising wildly now. He feels his moment has come.
And he's got a nickname for Tucker Carlson, which is Chatworth Catalson.
Oh, I see what he did there.
Right. Chatworth Catalson.
Catalson, yeah.
Now, apparently the Chatworth is an old Rush Limbaugh nickname referencing some show that was on TV in the 60s or something. Yeah. So that's a really kind of a old lost boomer reference. And then he's added the Catalson bit.
He's a wild, crazy wordsmith.
So I'll just read, right? Chatworth Catalson was far worse than a never-Trumper, far worse than a Donald Trump critic. His pure hate for the man as a human being was unhinged, abnormal, poisonous, as you can read yourself below. Those perverse and deeply troubling public impulses appear to have resurfaced. Disagreements and criticisms with any president are fair game. Hard-fought primaries can cause things to be said that people regret. But this is much different. Together with his weird, nervous laugh, promotion of anti-Semites, attraction to Putin, in my opinion, I fear something is way off, says Mark Levin. Dave Smith has always been a sick bastard. Ask yourself why he was promoted by the fake MAGA podcasters and the likes of Chatworth's Catalson. Islamist Nazi slaughter over 100 Christians in Nigeria. Big poll. Did you know that 72% of the US support attacking Iran if necessary? Right? Or 72% of Trump supporters support it? I believe that. I've got something to sell you, you know. And he's just, it's on and on and on. I think it's just nonstop all day.
He rankles with bitterness, doesn't he?
Oh, it's just there's real MAGA and there's fake MAGA. Real MAGA is supporting the war in Iran, right? Yeah. And agreeing with Lindsey Graham and Ted Cruz. And fake MAGA are trash. People who side with David Duke and Bernie Sanders and Rashida Tlaib. So MAGA is not divided. It's stronger than ever. Trump is stronger than ever.
Sam Harris will be coming out as real MAGA next week.
It's like
IRA, isn't it? Real IRA, continuity IRA.
I just can't believe they're running this playbook. It's just so horrible. Some of the stuff that I've seen over the past week is truly mental. Did you see what Bill Mitchell posted the other day?
Yeah.
Bill Mitchell, right? Bill Mitchell says, has anyone considered the possibility that America has miraculously survived so many close calls over the centuries that it is our purpose to defend Israel? If we quit Israel, I believe God may quit us, and I'm not prepared to take that chance.
Was he dressed as Charlton Heston, as Moses, carrying some tablets in his hand at that point?
It
sounds like he's aiming for a sword and sandal film.
It's just beyond. I just can't believe some of the stuff we've seen.
Well, this is what I said about existential tiredness at the beginning. It is just kind of, it's just battering away at you with sheer nonsense.
So, yeah. Anyway. That's MAGA. That's the populist revolt, guys. It's literally just John McCain again. It's just all this shit that we're watching here again.
Yeah.
Thank you.
America and the coalition forces invaded Afghanistan not just to find those behind the attacks on America, but also to transform Afghanistan into a modern democracy. It was a grand plan, but the logic behind it was simple. If the innocent people of Afghanistan could be liberated from the evil forces that had terrorized them, then they would become free individuals. And out of that, a democracy, like those in the West, would grow naturally.
But this was a fantasy.
Hold on a second, please. Yeah, he's recalling us to what he talked about in The Power of Nightmares, sort of a parallel in the vision between the neocons and Bin Laden, right? But what, was it the neocons? Like, I know the neocons are behind almost every war of the last sort of 25 years or more, but was it the neocons who pushed for America to attack Afghanistan? Because I don't really remember too well at the time. I just remember it being in the news, but because Iraq was, the second Iraq war was definitely a neocon war, wasn't it? But was the invasion of Afghanistan driven by the Richard Pearls and the
of course it was.
Okay, because it's much further from Israel, right? So it's not such an obvious reason for them, But is it because they're trying to sort of prove their concept or something? Like, we can, was it to build trust for other wars or something?
The kind of proximate motivation was for revenge for 9/11, right?
Even though they, of all people, this sort of violates your channel.
The proximate cause of the wanting to go into Afghanistan was to find the Osama bin Laden, root out the people who had done 9/11, and as revenge for knocking down the World Trade Center. So,
obviously, that should have really targeted Tel Aviv. But anyway, sorry, let's move on.
Tens of thousands of Americans and Europeans would pass through the country.
I'll just say I believe the official story, and I always have, of 9/11.
Sorry.
Yeah. Although there are still unanswered questions as to why Saudi Arabia, to go back to this documentary, the early parts of it, why, all of the guys who did it were Saudi Arabian, so how come they never went after the Saudis?
That's my naive question, but Zed Viet in the chat just said Afghanistan is next to Iran, so that's a reason.
As a sort of soft bridgehead.
Yeah,
staging post. Just to use the contrast in that focused image there of the helicopter taking off, I mean, Kurt is talking about the idea, free individuals, democracy would arise naturally, in the open marketplace of ideas, and talking about it being a ruthless simplification, because as ever with neocons, what he's showing us is a great big gun. It doesn't arise democracy ground up.
Over the next 10 years, soldiers, diplomats, experts, political advisors, and journalists, all of them trying to build this new society. But few of them stopped to think whether what had happened to the Russians 20 years before might also happen to them. That in a strange way, Afghanistan has revealed to us the emptiness and hypocrisy of many of our beliefs. And that we may be returning from there, also haunted by Mujahideen ghosts. Knowing that underneath, we believe in nothing.
Curtis getting oddly based here in this segment.
Yeah. And it's interesting the sort of contrast he uses of the dancing, He uses this as a visual metaphor for the kind of sleepy indolence of the West, and he always shows these kinds of tired old boomers dancing away. But when he first shows the Afghans dancing, it's got a sort of vitality about it. They dance in a way that seems less kind of lost, if you know what I mean. You know.
After the shock of the attacks in September 2001, the greatest fear was that the American economy might collapse as well. In response, the politicians, advised by their economic experts, cut interest rates to almost zero. This allowed cheap money to flood through the system and avoid disaster. The banks lent money to anyone and everyone. It was the politicians looking to the financial system to stabilize the country.
Of course, Ludwig von Mises would say credit expansion leads to
malinvestment,
and then a crash. This is the Misesian cycle. This is the money cycle that he made his name on, Mises. That was what he was famous for. And as far as I can tell, it's basically just correct every single time.
Yeah, in Austrian economics, there's a natural rate of there's always a rate of interest. It's not set by the state; it exists, and the market shows it. And when the state takes that over, it signals one way or the other wrong things to the market, and people make poor investments based on it,
like buying condos in Ireland or stuff like that.
Right.
At the same time, thousands of experts and advisors flooded into Afghanistan. Their aim was to transform the country into a modern democracy. This optimistic vision of a future Afghanistan was celebrated in the Kabul Stadium. It was the same stadium where the Russians had celebrated their new model for Afghanistan 20 years before.
Last year, we think that we never can be alive again. We will die. But now we are thinking that we are alive again, and we are too happy. And also from America, that they help a lot. We are very appreciative of them. Thanks a lot. I think now everything is normal. The man and woman can work in one place, no any different between them. And I think everything is going to good day by day. And this is our school.
That's your school board. Yeah. Okay.
So she was. She was speaking for the Taliban there.
No.
Is that right?
No. She's a high school girl. That was filmed in Kabul in 2002. Her name is Menina. Oh. There's a bit of BBC Russia's that Curtis has used there, which he's posted up elsewhere. So, no. He was just interviewing young Afghan women who, the BBC were interviewing young Afghan women who were just talking about the sort of optimism of the moment.
And they happened to find one who was good-looking, spoke English, and she was a feminist. That's
well, there was at least a couple that were interviewed on the Rushes. The other one is not so good-looking. He chose the clip of the good-looking one.
We're about to see one of the most embarrassing things that's ever happened in British history.
Yes.
All kinds of groups came to Kabul to help the project. It was like a snapshot of what those in power in America and Britain believe made democracy work. As well as the obvious lessons in how to organise elections and conferences on how to stop the narcotics trade, young Afghan students were also given lessons in how to make conceptual art.
So this is in some ways often called the first piece of conceptual art.
میگه این رکمه میبینیم نمونه ایره با بعضی مردم اولین کار هنری مفکوره ای میگن
Does anyone know what it is?
شما کسی میفهمه چی است؟
I don't expect the ladies to know.
کمود است.
Exactly. An artist called Marcel Duchamp, who's very important in Western art, put this toilet in an art gallery about 100 years ago. It was a huge revolution.
Are you ready to see how it is used?
Do you want to go first, Horace?
No, you go first.
Oh, well. Oh, this is the famous section that's come up again recently in reference to Rory Stewart. That was the a group called the Turquoise Mountain Project. If you remember back in the last episode, they looked at Joanne Herring, the Texan socialite, who went to the Mujahideen in the 80s. Herring was a sort of philanthropist as well as, you know, probably being an asset of the agency. And she founded something called the Marshall Plan Charities, which was to, quote, complement the ongoing US military effort in Afghanistan by rapidly and effectively redeveloping normal, healthy civilian life village by village. The organization unites the efforts of various NGOs concerned with the Afghan people in hopes of providing villagers with clean water, food, healthcare, schools, and jobs. And the Turquoise Mountain Foundation was founded in 2006. A combination of Prince Charles and Hamid Karzai, the president of Afghanistan, to create jobs, teach skills, and foster national identity. Based in Kabul, it was aimed at regenerating historic urban areas and renewing traditional Afghan arts and architecture and promoting sustainable development of Afghanistan's crafts industry. They were working to restore historic buildings in the old city, manage finances, install water supply, electricity, and establish clinics, schools, and an institute for traditional crafts. So very similar to the earlier kind of philanthropy of Joanne Herring. It was run by Shoshana Clark, later Shoshana Stewart, who is Rory Stewart's wife. And this is why this has come up again in recent times as a sort of indicator of how we misjudge, let's say, what the important things are that we're bringing to countries and the sort of soft power vectors by which we're doing it. Interestingly, Brad Pitt bought the rights to make a movie about Rory Stewart's wife in 2008.
So, are they friends?
I don't know, but obviously it's a kind of it's a vehicle for, you know, another kind of Charlie Wilson's war, another kind of heroic, you know, white savior, so to speak, going out to the benighted folk of Afghanistan and raising them up through the power of conceptual art.
And obviously the Turquoise Mountain Foundation, was it? They were funded by USAID, and I'm sure they're involved with the British Council as well, which is... British Council probably gets USAID funding as well. I don't know, but the British Council, like, for anyone who doesn't know, was founded in the mid-1930s by the same people at the Foreign Office who helped form the Focus that introduced Winston Churchill to it, which was the anti-Nazi council, the sort of war party, the sort of like a extremely lavishly funded war group in Britain in the 30s that helped bring about war in Germany. The British Council was founded out of the Foreign Office to help the same efforts to vilify fascists, not communists, right? It was effectively pro-communist because of the politics of the time. And ever since, the British Council has been going around telling the world that what, like, the essence of Britain is like defeating fascism, which means, you know, everything right wing, basically. And obviously it's evolved since then, but I just find this like one of the most egregious things that these soft power propaganda people have ever done, telling people from the mountains of Afghanistan that this is important to Western art. That's not true, right? Duchamp was important in terms of the art industry. Obviously contributed nothing whatsoever to art itself, right? Specifically the art industry and art agents. Nothing to do with art. It's nothing to do with our culture. It's just to do with what they can sell, and that's it. So I particularly despise these people who say that this is part of Western culture. It's not at all. It's a poncy, pretentious thing that affects a few urbanites. That's it.
Mm. I mean, my general observation is just that it just seems so disconnected from anything. I mean, to understand that, you'd need the relevant context of like 1,000 years of British art or the European art or something like that.
History as well.
Right, and history and the root and just everything. They're sitting with people who don't even know what a urinal is.
Hmm.
Yeah. So it's just like, okay, how about like walking before you can run? You know, they're just starting there, which has always been one of my issues with progressive. You know, I talked about this when I went on Lotus Eaters to talk about Trivium, where it's like, oh, people can't do, like students, school pupils can't do basic syntax. They don't even know how to write. And they're asking them to do feminist deconstructions of poems and things like this. It's like, well, how about like just being able to like know what a sentence is first? You know what I mean? They always want to do this thing where you're kind of starting right at the end, or you're kind of
the lady we saw there giving the lesson. Like, we should we take it that she had already proceeded through, you know, Bellini and Leonardo da Vinci and stuff, and we just arrived. We just see the moment where she arrives at the 20th century.
You're sort of seeing a sort of speed run of Western cultural breakdown, and we're feeding it to the Afghans. I mean, that the expression on that woman's face is the sort of swallowing of the bigger black pill than they'd ever seen.
I mean, the expression on the Afghan student's face just says it all. Like, I mean, I'm with her. You know, I'm on her side.
Underlying it all was a belief that the battle was to create a good society, one that would be strong enough to stand against the bad, anti-democratic forces that had overwhelmed Afghanistan. But then it began to get confusing. The Americans discovered that it was very difficult to know exactly who was good and who was bad. When they had invaded, they had been helped by Afghans who were already fighting the Taliban. The Americans had assumed that they would then help to create the new democracy and appointed many of them to run the country. But now it turned out that many of them were actually the very same corrupt and violent warlords who the Taliban had overthrown. And they were using their new power to terrorize the country all over again. Gulagha Sherzai had been made governor of Kandahar. But he was also alleged to be making $1 million a week from running the opium trade, while at the same time siphoning off millions from the Americans in inflated contracts. When President Karzai was persuaded to remove Sherzai, he simply made him governor of another province. But he was not alone. Throughout much of Afghanistan, the warlords had returned to power. But this time it was worse. The massive influx of American money allowed them to extend their networks of bribery and corruption.
By the way, do you remember what I said? Loads of them had ended up in, loads of Afghanis had ended up in Iran. It's all of these people you're seeing here. Like, they're these soldiers or even some of these corrupt warlords and things, they ended up in Iran afterwards. You know, as if they wouldn't cause trouble there as well. And they have them.
To every corner of Afghan society.
هیچ کس پرسانه ما را نمیکنه یک ما میشه دیجا برو بیا سر شازاده ایجا جور کرده
او را کسیر به پیسو و ستا خبره دو پا ولا بینا نه اککت وی نه حق وی نه حق تا اککت سو کیه لیشی
هر شعبه که بری بدون رشبت بدون اقداری هیچ کار نمیشه
قدر که ظلم دلی سو هم قسم میکنه
مستقیما گفته به در $18,000 تو دوامی دیمو کارتا جور میکنه
چرگی بود افغانی رو مسئلهش بود حالی گپ دلار دلار هر کس نداره.
But the money was not just corrupting individuals. It was undermining the whole structure of society. Above all, the police.
Bowie again, by the way.
Yeah, is that from Vasawa?
I believe it's, second title low.
Yeah. Interesting bits that we've just gone past there in terms of music. There's a bit of Brian Eno, a very understated bit, that called Slow Water, that he did for a Derek Jarman film called Jubilee, which Mr. D recently reviewed. So go and have a look on his timeline on Twitter if you want to check out that. But interesting little connection there.
We mentioned Jubilee the other week, didn't we?
You might have done.
I did.
Rather than enforcing the law, the police had become transformed into violent militias who worked for the warlords.
I mean, part of me, through doing this whole sequence, was thinking, like, they could be Americans. The relationship between these warlords And the Afghani people is not a million miles away from the relationship between the evil overlords of America and the general population, or even the relationship between MAGA leadership and its base. You know, just seems exactly the same to me. I mean, maybe they're a little less overtly brutal, but it's basically the same exploitative relationship, you know, writ large.
They organized a massive expansion of the drug trade, and they also terrorized the local people. Ordinary Afghans came to hate the police, and they saw them as the enemy. And the Americans also weren't as good as they appeared. Jack Adema had been portrayed as a hero, working with the US Special Forces to hunt down bin Laden. He had arrived in Kabul 3 years before and become a legendary figure. CBS television had made an hour-long special about the secret world of terror that Adema had discovered in the mountains. It showed a tape that he said he had found of the Al-Qaeda group training. But then Adema was arrested. The Americans said that he was a fake. He had nothing to do with them and had conned CBS. They alleged that Adema had a dungeon hidden underneath his house in Kabul where he tortured innocent Afghans.
Tell him basically I'm tired of the lies. Where's his village? In 3 minutes, he'll be dead.
Adema was put on trial in Kabul. He insisted, though, that he had been working with the highest levels of the US military and government.
I know how long it took you, bastard.
Jack, who are you working for, man?
We were working for the US counterterrorist group and working with the Pentagon and some other federal
agencies.
So
you're working with US knowledge, with US government knowledge?
We were in touch with the Pentagon sometimes five times a day at the highest level, every day.
Well, this guy is an absolute nutbar, and if you want to go and look him up, there's an interesting documentary on YouTube called The King of Stolen Valor, and I might post a little clip from that later. He was a guy, Jack Adema, Jonathan Adema. He joined the Green Berets in the mid-70s. He basically was a sort of narcissistic psychopath. I mean, the army pinged him quite quickly as a sort of irrational, dangerous, immature guy. He was discharged honorably after about 3 years, but then the army literally banned him from ever coming back. He was that bad. So he made up a crock about having been a very experienced special forces soldier. He tried to, you know, sell all sorts of phony stories to the FBI about Russian mafia smuggling backpack nukes into the US. He was convicted of fraud. He tried to sue the FBI. He tried to sue Steven Spielberg for allegedly ripping off a part of his he'd done like a movie treatment about his life, and he said that Spielberg had tried to sort of rip it off and use it as the basis of the plot.
Well, I support that, obviously.
The Peacekeeper with George Clooney, but he had to sort of pay costs against Spielberg. He lost about $267,000, which he didn't pay off. He was basically a fantasist. He sort of rocked up to Afghanistan looking for the $25 million reward for bin Laden. And he sort of crowbarred himself into a security detail for a documentary about humanitarian work. And essentially, he was again, sussed to be a fantasist by the journalists on the ground. They'd call him like Mr. Potato Head because he kept changing his story about, you know, whether he was a private military contractor or he was special forces or he was CIA. They also called him Jack Shit. And he sold these tapes of you know, Al-Qaeda training, allegedly. He even got Dan Rather over from 60 Minutes to come and sort of do a little feature on him He nicked Anderson Cooper's old cameraman to bomb around Afghanistan with, sort of making himself look good, you know. And there was all sorts of stories. And so what he's saying there about, you know, being in touch with the US wanted absolutely nothing to do with him. This thing about him being in touch with the Pentagon five times a day, it's true. He kept ringing the office of a guy called General Boykin, and their staff would just sort of tell him that the general was out and just say things to make him go away, just to sort of get rid of him. They just put as much distance as they could between, you know, them and him. He claimed he was sort of doing black ops, you know, for 10 years for the US. So he had no kind of history that anyone could establish. But he somehow managed to convince, you know, some of the coalition forces in Afghanistan that he was legit. And he did abduct people, hold them in a house, torture them, waterboard them, as you saw there. And eventually he was, nicked, as it says, and put on trial. He also used to carry around with him, interestingly, the DNA of an old dog he had called Sarge, who, you know, used to parachute out of planes with him and sniff out bombs. And he said he was going to try and clone Sarge one day. You know, he ran a sort of pet holiday resort early on in his career. So he was he was all over the place. He was a nutty guy.
Was he actually working for the Pentagon?
No, not at all. He was a complete fantasist. He just turned up, said he was going to catch Bin Laden. He organized a sort of paramilitary force called, was it something like Secret Saber 7 or something like that? It was just ridiculous. And all the journalists and the actual military people knew that he was off his rocker. But the thing was, you know, there were so many guys in Afghanistan at that time cleaning up, making money, doing private military work. So he was just another one of those guys with, you know, dark shades on and bits of American uniform, bombing around in a car without a license plate and looking like he was involved in some way. So he fabricated the impression very greatly, but he was absolutely nothing to do with them.
Wow.
How do you feel about being sort of let go by the Americans?
Fucked.
Use that quote.
Well, there you go. That's the quote, my dear. This government and our government knew every single thing we were doing.
Jack Adema was found guilty and sent to jail. But then it got even more confusing, because reports emerged that the real American military had been doing exactly the same as Jack Adema. They had set up a special torture center in an old Soviet hangar at Bagram Air Base. Ordinary Afghans were shackled to the ceiling and subjected to all kinds of violent abuse. But they went further than Jack Adema. The report said that two of the victims had been tortured to death.
Of course, it was very provocative. People were very angry. And I think it's important to understand that when this kind of art emerged...
Great. Great jump cut from Curtis. So,
just to cap off the story of Jack Adema, by the way, he eventually returned to the US. He conned this woman who he was sent to prison. It was kind of luxury jail, and there's interviews with him where he was in prison where he's clearly grandiosely delusional. This Australian guy is interviewing him, and he's saying, "Do you think I'm a prisoner? I can walk out of here any time. I can summon 1,000 Panjshir warriors to come and free me." Basically, he ended up hanging out in Mexico with a twink called Fernando and a trans prostitute called Nancy, running orgies. And he died of AIDS in 2012.
AIDS?
Yeah. His girlfriend started to notice he was more interested in men, and he developed a sort of interesting coterie of hangers-on and got in big time into drugs, all kinds of sort of fly-by-night money-making schemes he tried. And he just sort of went out in a blaze of methamphetamine, coke, and HIV.
Not glory.
No.
What? His name was Jack Adema. Jack Enema, more like.
he once changed his name to Jack Black because he thought it sounded cool. He was completely unaware of the...
That Jack Black, yeah.
Hollywood actor, yeah. Yeah.
I was just reminded of that song, you know. It's better to burn out than it is to fade.
Are you
that, was my, that was my Neil Young impression.
Are you able to play a clip from a different source, AA, if I just ping it to you in the private chat? Because this is quite a telling little clip you might just want to show of Jackademia. I'll just put it in the...
AA, that line was delivered better by Clancy Brown in Highlander. You seen Highlander?
Yeah,
I don't remember that. I don't remember
the cello. So towards the latter part of the film, they meet in the church where they, for whatever reason, the rules of the immortals mean they can't fight in holy ground. But he still delivers a threat to him, and he says, "It is better to burn it. It's a fade away." And then he just growls it.
He does this slightly cringy kind of idea of a badass, you know. He's a guy wearing like a leather waistcoat with spikes on, isn't he? And
it's a film that's like half good and half ridiculous.
Little clip from the documentary Stolen about King of Stolen Valor about Jackademia. I think you'll find it very interesting.
Nothing made any sense in his mind. It was all perfectly normal, but it was just more paranoia on top of paranoia.
One of the only videos featuring Jack that's publicly available is called Jackademia Christmas Katana. In it, he studies the blade in his backyard.
He'd be out there with a sword like that. And if I didn't play with him, that's what he would say. Come on out and play with me with your sword. It's like little kids, you get dressed up and you play whatever you know, cops and robbers, we'll play swords. Get dressed up in your sword outfit. So I would stand out there for a few minutes, play swords. And then just put the sword down and go in the house. And he'd start screaming, yelling, ranting, raving, and run around and start chopping everything up. And then he'd put the music back on and play swords by himself. Nothing made any sense.
Just wonder if that reminded you of anyone. Studying the blade, swishing around a massive sword.
Who've you got in mind?
I've worked on a few levels.
James Lindsay.
Right.
Just thought it was great clip. Very suggestive.
I forgot about that. There's actually clips of him swinging swords around, isn't
just it? It was just so similar. I just thought I had to bring it up, you know.
I always forget about that aspect of Lindsay.
Partly political. It was to fight against the system and say, what is art is what I think it is.
One of the biggest concerns we have is about the civilian casualties that took place because of the result of cluster bombs.
Okay, that's fine.
Okay, is that fly going to...
I can hear it, actually.
You can, can't you? It's a blowy.
It'll land.
It's a blowy. Fuck off. It's a bug.
Go. This is an interview about casualties, so it's going to be one more.
Speaking of today, Jesus wept.
On the whole, I think everyone's finds it a very important event, and even more so the fact that we're abroad and not able to celebrate it at home. Hence, we're very happy to do some small token towards the Queen's celebrations.
And why? Why a beacon here in Kabul?
I have absolutely no idea.
By 2006, the British and the Americans realised that their project to bring democracy to Afghanistan was failing, and large parts of the country were descending into anarchy. In Helmand, in southern Afghanistan, armed groups had risen up and there was constant fighting. The coalition were convinced that this was the return of the Taliban, and British troops were sent there to restore order and to help protect the regional government. But when the British commanders asked the Ministry of Defence for information about what was happening in Helmand, there was none. There weren't even any satellites looking at it. They had all been moved to look at Iraq. The one thing they did know was that they were going to the very heartland of the tribe that had decisively defeated the British 125 years before at the Battle of Maiwand. The British commander called a meeting of the local elders. It was in the very same town that the American engineers had built 50 years before when they were constructing the dam across the Helmand River.
All three of us for security, governance, and for development. We are the three who work together as a British. I know you've seen many foreigners arriving in your country.
The commander reassured the elders that the British were there to defeat the Taliban and support the regional government.
My forefathers were even here before.
Next door, his officers were preparing to entertain the elders with a showing of David Attenborough's series, The Blue Planet. But the elders thought that the British had completely misunderstood the problem. The real enemy was not the Taliban, but the corrupt and vicious government that President Karzai had installed in Helmand and was doing nothing to stop.
Anton, Mr. President Karzai, will bring a good governance, the secure situation would be the same. If you were here for 100 years, it would be not good. Once he brought good governance, good people to the government, then we have hope that security-wise will be changed.
The elders left without watching the Blue Planet. Before they came to Helmand, the British had forced President Karzai to get rid of its governor. But they didn't realise that he had left behind him a completely corrupted society. And nothing was what it seemed.
Pause. So just that example there is kind of emblematic of one of the problems of Afghanistan that Curtis is reviewing. There's this weakness of the bureaucratised liberal approach to managerialism. In terms of, you know, communicating, as you see there, with the elders, and all the sort of competencies of diplomacy from the past basically get devolved into a kind of attitude on the part of the British or the coalition of how can we get what we want without really giving you anything back other than just treating you like children, giving you entertainment. Yeah. And it's very much like when you see Dominic Cummings. Recently, he's criticizing the competences in Whitehall, you know, that just as it is in domestic governance, so it is in these counterinsurgency operations. Curtis talks about this in a recent piece. He talks about when the economists invented a system called new public management to control society. New public management said it was dangerous to leave people to motivate themselves through fuzzy notions such as doing good. Instead, you created systems that monitored everyone through targets and incentives, constantly watching and rewarding or punishing. It was the birth of modern HR, human resources. And anyone who's ever dealt with HR and their monitoring systems knows instinctively that they don't trust you, which is, you know, kind of what you see in that that sequence. You know, you've got the little clip of, you know, the Scots Guards, you know, playing the bagpipes there. They're sort of... It's very dissonant, you know, this idea that transplanting your traditions to Afghanistan, but at the same time not understanding their traditions, not accepting, if you like, their notion of hierarchy or what is actually real to them. And that example there of the British thinking they can sort of palm them off with showing a David Attenborough documentary and the elder saying, you don't really understand the problem. It's corrupt governance that's the issue here, you know, which you've effectively exacerbated at that point.
What was the idea of showing the Attenborough documentary? As if, like, what, to sedate them or to seduce
yeah.
them?
I think that's it, yeah. Yeah, you don't really address any of their actual issues, and you give them a sort of consolatory kind of bit of soft power product. I mean, this feeds into... Stuff that Curtis wrote on his blog at this in 2010 when he was building up to doing this documentary. He talked about something the American military tried, which is called the human terrain system. He says this, the idea is simple. Instead of concentrating only on fighting on the physical terrain, cities, deserts, and mountains in Afghanistan, the aim is to get inside the minds of the Afghan people, the human terrain, to find out how they see the world, how they think and feel, and then with that knowledge to exploit and control this human terrain by engineering new ways of thinking inside the minds of the Afghan people. The project was created by an American anthropologist with a fantastic name, Montgomery McFate. She was born in 1966. Her parents were counterculture radicals in the heart of the experimental art scene in San Francisco, so she's very much second-generation cool. She became a punk in the Bay Area in the early 80s. She grew up to be a serious anthropologist who liked to study conflicts. In the early 90s, she says that she went and studied the Provisional IRA and the British soldiers in Belfast and then wrote a thesis about how they saw each other. Then in 2004, she was studying the American army and became convinced that one of the reasons for the disasters in both Iraq and Afghanistan was because there weren't any anthropologists in the military. There was no one to tell the soldiers and generals why the insurgents were attacking them. There was absolutely no understanding of what anthropologists call the social and cultural knowledge of their adversaries. So Montgomery McFate decided to rectify that. And in 2005, she went on the attack. She wrote an article for the Military Review called Anthropology and Counterinsurgency, The Strange Story of Their Curious Relationship. In it, McFate brilliantly took apart the academic discipline of anthropology and its pompous pretensions of neutrality. She went back into its history and showed how anthropology from the very beginning had evolved as an intellectual tool to consolidate Britain's power in its empire. And then Curtis says, I rang Montgomery McFate and asked her what she thought anthropology could offer the American military in Afghanistan. Immediately, she said, cultural relativism. I asked her for an example. She told me how one of her human terrain teams had been working in the large US base in Khost in eastern Afghanistan. The American troops there had noticed how Afghan workers on the base disappeared into the bushes outside the base with young Afghan boys every Thursday. It became known as Man-Boy Love Thursday. The Americans running the base had decided it was wrong. They worried about elder men preying sexually on young boys. They wanted to arrest the Afghan men, but the human terrain team persuaded the base commanders that this was an accepted part of Afghan sexual culture. And Curtis rounds it off saying, I wonder how long it will be before the anthropologists start telling the military that what they think of as, quotes, corruption is in reality a deep-rooted system of tribal patronage in Afghanistan that they should just accept. So there's your top-down social engineering.
What should this end up with? Yeah, so just let the Taliban be in charge. Oh, look what happened.
Yeah.
When the British went into towns like Sangin, they tried to support the police. But the police were really the armed militia for the sacked governor. To the locals, this meant that the Western troops were supporting their oppressors. So they started to attack the British.
Get inside!
Shit,
a bear. That's close, that one out the back there.
It was.
Right, mate, get under.
See that, them.
Shit. They're overshooting on us.
Stay down, lads, stay down.
Wait, is that incoming, all right? Come in.
Fucking incoming,
then. The British thought that...
So, Simon, how did all of that result in shit like trying to show them David Attenborough documentaries and the urinal? Or was that a different project altogether?
I do not know. I do not know. Well, the British Army, you will actually see a guy coming up who deals in a similar sort of thing for the British Army. But... you know, it was obviously decided that as there was a sort of strategic and, you know, at ground level tactical impasse with Afghanistan, the only real way was to kind of use soft power dynamics as the only form of persuasion available. You know, I can't account for why they wrap themselves in such baffling notions of fighting a war. Because again, you go back to that thing of Cummings talking about the civil service. You know, back in the sort of 18th, 19th century, you know, handfuls of people who were supremely competent and who addressed the actual issues. You know, Cummings, he's talking about recently, you know, things like when they were doing their bit organizing, you know, the response to COVID, you know, they get a handful of, you know, SAS officers who would just get stuff done. And yet now everything is extended through the soft power bureaucracy. go figure. You know,
this must mean they were
sorry.
The Taliban. So in response, they dropped giant bombs on them.
Fucking hell. Did you get that, did you?
Yes, I did.
Fucking hell.
Pause.
Holy shit.
Sorry, just actually finish off what I was saying. I think one of the reasons is the problem is that we, in the liberal paradigm, can't accept their systems of traditional structure. So you know, we in effect end up fighting a new enemy that we create by, you know, misinterpreting them through our bureaucratized systems of thinking and not, you know, responsive, what you might call military entrepreneurialism that Cummings is talking about. We just don't face the real issues anymore. We recreate the enemy as liberals who are just, you know, it's like people talk about, you know, boys these days in schools are treated as dysfunctional girls. We're treating these people as dysfunctional liberals who just need to be made to catch up.
Yeah, there's like a certain unwillingness to admit that they even exist as they really are, right? That
they
are the way they are.
Yeah. It's not responding to you as you are. It's responding to you as we think you need to be, but you're not there yet. So we pull you up with showing you the blue planet and talking about conceptual art instead of accepting you are a system that's highly reactionary, traditional, structured.
Different.
Different. It's
just different from us.
And, you know, so our system is you know, fundamentally cannot lose face by accepting their standards, so to speak. You know, and if we do accept their standards, we make them into a sort of a cultural, you know, affect, like the bachabazi, like the sexual abuse. You know, well, that's just what they do. You know, it's traditional as a headdress.
Like, we're all people who, you know, we're against the anti-woke sort of thing because that's just the left trying to rescue itself, right? But the one thing, like, the anti-woke people I've seen, they point out that is true, is that a lot of lefties, they actually really despise the rest of the world. They are the most haughty, snobbish, sort of Western chauvinist people there are. Obviously, they don't admit that to themselves and they believe they're the opposite. But it is them who sees the rest of the world as a kind of disease or something that needs to be solved. And it's us who accepts the world as it is. I just have no desire to determine the fate of Afghanistan. That's the idea of trying to determine that is so far from my thinking. It's absurd.
Yeah.
And yet, like, people like Rory Stewart or whatever, I don't even know who epitomizes the people behind all this. It's them. They really cannot stand the rest of the world to be as it is. They can't stand
it. It's the Game of Thrones meme, isn't it? The white savior.
Yeah. And you just,
you know, Daenerys on the sea.
Like, yeah, like, we wouldn't see ourselves as saving these people. We would see ourselves as interfering, right?
Yeah. But you consider how long it's taken domestically for the acceptance of, you know, things like ethnic-based grooming, sexual grooming gangs.
That has to be untrue. That has to not be real.
Yeah. See how long it takes to even just get that. I mean, that's just now becoming, they're just starting to deal with that. So, you know, in Afghanistan, obviously, there was no chance there of getting that to be accepted by the, you know, the coalition systems that were in play.
I'm on the same spectrum, right? It's only when I read that book, Easy Meat, about 5-6 years ago, by Pete McLaughlin, the one book that comprehensively covers the rape gang scandal in Britain, and the process of actually targeting, identifying which girls they want to begin abusing and stuff like that. That was new to me from that book, and only then did I actually begin to appreciate. Yeah, this is what barbarism really means. This is what it is, right? It's vile in a way that I could never have imagined. In that sense, I was on the same spectrum as these deluded Westerners, right? Like, it never occurred to me that people could have such malevolence. And these guys, they really fight accepting it. They really, I mean, even now, you saw the way some people reacted yesterday. Peter Jukes was one. I mean, Sheila Fogarty. I know these are ridiculous people. But the way they reacted, that I'm still denying it. I'm just not accepting that this is a thing. They're just still fighting it in their own minds, let alone fighting everyone else as well.
Well, in a way, it's a kind of it's a follow on from the stuff that actually Curtis talks about in the new documentary, which he sort of covered before, the adoption of James Buchanan's public choice theory, and this idea that you have to change the incentive structure for the blob, for the liberal bureaucracy, because it's dangerous, essentially, to allow people to operate with, you know, ideas about what is good and what is bad. You can only sort of run these extensive bureaucracies by formalizing it into incentives based on self-interest only. And so these other factors simply cannot be seen in that sort of, you know, matrix of compliance that they operate through. You know,
so it becomes rigid and unresponsive in that sense.
Yeah. And that's a lot of what Curtis is, to be fair. He is criticizing scathingly about the failures of the systems that were brought in, you know, during the Thatcher era, you know. Mm-hmm.
There's a lot about that. In that, there's this documentary called, I think it's Tory, 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 and there's a little section on that in the public choice thing. They have the guy who wrote Yes Minister, and they present him as like the epitome of the public choice views, in like the civil service runs badly because their incentives really could scarcely allow them to operate in any other way. They look out for themselves.
But this then devastated the town centres, which made even more local people join in the attacks. Seeing their chance, the real ideological Taliban, who were now based in Pakistan, flooded back in, and they started attacking the British too. At the same time, the corrupt militias, who worked for the local government, also turned against the British. Faced by the chaos, the British still clung to their simple narrative of good and evil. They, the Western forces, were good, and all the different groups who were attacking them were Taliban and were bad. But this extraordinary simplification had terrible consequences. Because if you were an Afghan and wanted to kill a rival, all you had to do was go to the British and tell them that he was a Taliban. And the British would obediently wipe him out.
Pause, please. Yeah, I just want to endorse that thing, the very simple formulation that Curtis just made. I really think that is, it goes to the heart of what is different between us and the people who rule over us. Like, well, some of them. It really is just a case of we are good and they are evil. The effect of that is that you think you can do evil without being evil, right? Because you're good. You're in the good camp, and you can do harsh things. You know, like end justifies the means becomes your philosophy, really. And it's like it's a simple statement, but it is profound as well. It's like, I think that's worth emphasizing.
Yeah,
but as long as, like, there's that phrase, to the pure of heart, all things are permissible. I think about that a lot.
Yeah.
Oh, fuck, get out!
The British were being used. The terrible truth was that the British presence did not contain the war. It did the very opposite. It escalated it so much that it ran out of control. And the bodies, Afghan and British, piled up.
Can I just say, these guys think they can take Iran. Fucking hell. This is a disaster. It hadn't quite dawned on me what a disaster this campaign was. Because in the public imagination, it's just like, oh, right, well, you know, Iraq, okay, it went initially, and then it kind of, you know, there was trouble later type thing. The Afghanistan one seemed to be, like, done and dusted pretty quickly. And there was, in terms of the news, I mean, there was a new government there. And then, all of a sudden, like 20 years later, America and Britain leave, and now the Taliban are back in charge. But what this is showing, basically, is that it was a fuck-up from start to finish, pretty much.
Yeah.
It was just a disaster, wasn't it? Let's face it.
Yeah, and I think, I mean, a lot of it thematically, as we sort of draw, you know, into this last bit of Bitter Lake, is really Curtis is making this point that, you know, it's a kind of like a, you know, the way that Vietnam is processed through war films now is that this is a kind of terrain where we fill it because of its, you know, in a sense, because of its literal emptiness, we fill it with all of the kind of things that bother us. I mean, this is, I think, he was very affected, I think, when he did Surgery of the Self by the sort of the way Freud thought about people in groups. I think he sees Afghanistan as a sort of playing out of that idea of a sort of a Freudian subconscious represented in a landscape. This is why he uses all of these motifs of, you know, puffs of smoke and explosions, like I've said, about something arising from the landscape. And, you know, with this analysis, it, with Curtis in particular, it comes down to us. It's us bringing our problems there, playing them out, and they just don't work. And because we don't believe anything in the West anymore, you know, we believe in these shattered, you know, postmodern histories that you see there played out with the, with the kind of the art project there. We're simply going into a space where we have no, you know, we have no means of acknowledging what they are and how they are and how they live. We are only sort of, you know, I mean, to steal a line from Platoon, you know, we were really fighting ourselves.
The dynamic was one of manipulation. They understood how we saw the conflict. They presented their local group conflict, their civil war between groups that had been going on for 35 years. They presented everything in that dynamic. So they came to us and said, those people over there are Taliban. And we went, okay, and we went off and dealt with them. But actually, we were dealing with their previous enemies, so we were just creating more enemies for ourselves. And you ended up in a downward spiral where, because...
Well, why didn't they just do some basic investigations or stop and be like, hey, are you telling the truth? Because remember last time we did it and they weren't actually Taliban? Or,
yeah.
What is this? What is this kind of just, oh, yeah, okay. Yeah, we'll just kill. No problem. We'll just go and kill them. What the hell is this?
I mean, this is contrast in terms of sort of people savvy too. You know, when we go back to things like the Mayfair set, the way that the SAS were very effective, you know, this is back in the 60s and 70s, going into places like Oman, was they had this thing called hearts and minds strategies, you know, where they kind of went in and made as low an impact as they could on the local population in order to fight the communist rebels at the time. This guy, Mike Martin, actually is, again, one of these people who comes out of this, these kind of military anthropologists. He's actually a visiting research fellow at Department of War Studies at King's College London, where, as people will be familiar with, David Betts, who's doing the rounds at the moment, is also, located. And this guy, Mike Martin, he was interested in the evolutionary psychology of warfare in humans, internal conflict in societies and strategy formation. He's also now the Lib Dem MP for Tunbridge Wells, interestingly. So, it's all part of this sort of industry. He's called a British military cultural advisor.
Yeah, he comes across like he might have gone into something like that, even in this little clip. So, yeah.
Capitalized well, yeah.
Everyone was manipulating us. We ended up fighting everyone. And then in return, everyone who fought us immediately became Taliban. The way that we decided whether you were Taliban or not was whether you were firing at us. Post-2001, whereas we've understood the conflict as good, bad, black, white, government, Taliban, they've understood it as a shifting mosaic of different groups and leaders fighting each other, effectively over power. And the currency of power in Helmand is opium. That's largely what the conflict's about.
So what you're saying is that what we thought were the Taliban was actually an allergic reaction to us turning up into the middle of a complex civil war.
Correct.
We made things worse.
Yes.
Where was that?
That's over there, on the left.
Oh, for fuck's sake.
I pause.
But then the British and the...
That's a great, another visual motif again. You know, that's what Curtis is saying with that shot. We're missing the picture all the time. And there you have the kind of the genie rising up from the sand again.
He literally has the genie emerging from the lamp in the Power of Nightmares.
Yeah. And he uses that here.
Had to face up to the fact that they might not be as good and innocent as they thought they were. In 2009, the presidential elections were held. Hamid Karzai stood and allied himself with some of the most powerful warlords. But there were allegations that the warlords rigged the vote on a massive scale. This was backed up with videos that seemed to show the warlords' followers stuffing the ballot boxes with hundreds of fake voting papers. The coalition tried to rerun the election. But Karzai's main opponent refused, because he said it would be even more corrupt. So the British and the Americans had no choice but to abandon their great dream of a real democracy in Afghanistan. They gave in and allowed Karzai to become president again.
Entire American deep state taking notes on how they could make Biden the president in 2020.
I still don't trust that fella.
Things look rather bad, sir. What are we going to do?
Do, Captain? We're British. We won't do anything.
Till it's too late.
Precisely. That's the first sensible thing you've said today.
Thank you, sir.
Now, gentlemen, as always, we will carry on as if nothing was going to happen.
This morning, the Federal Reserve, with support of the Treasury Department, took additional actions to mitigate disruptions to our financial markets. Today's events are fast-moving. But the Chairman of the Federal Reserve and the Secretary of the Treasury are on top of them and will take the appropriate steps to promote stability in our markets.
And at the very same time as their simple plan was falling apart in Afghanistan, the politicians had to face a crisis at home. They had given power to the banks because the bankers and the financial technocrats had promised that they could hold the economy stable. But in 2008, the whole intricate system of credit and loans that the banks had created collapsed. And there was growing panic as giant financial institutions faced bankruptcy. The politicians in America and Britain stepped in and rescued the banks. As they did so, they began to discover that most of the major financial institutions were also riddled with corruption. But unlike President Roosevelt in the 1930s, they didn't then try and reform the system.
That is a, you know, when we're used to seeing the president and the prime minister together, you know, you often see Clinton and Blair, you see
Obama and Brown there, yeah.
Right, you see Bush and Blair. The Obama-Brown pairing is, I mean, I guess it was only there for a couple of years, right? But you don't see it that often.
No.
I'm used to, like, was it David Cameron, Obama, you must have seen at some point. But Trump and Boris. And now, of course, we've got Starmer and Trump. Who was the prime minister during Biden years?
Sunak. Take your pick.
Oh, well, about 8 million prime ministers, but... Mm. Yeah, the Brown Obama pairing seems like a kind of rare Pokemon to me. Just don't see that many images of them together.
Instead,
it's not like a Thatcher Reagan. You know what I mean? You don't think, oh, Brown Obama.
I think he was sort of saying it with that visual motif of the empty table there. It was just they just brought nothing to it.
They simply propped it up by literally pouring billions more pounds and dollars into the banks, hoping that this would somehow spread through the economies. They had no other idea. Okay.
pause a second. He was talking about the bailouts of 2008. Right?
Mm.
A lot of people attribute the inflation of the last 5 years to Rishi Sunak's bailouts of the lockdowns. Not just Sunak, obviously, it happened in all of the West. But a lot of the inflation that we experience, I think, still probably derives from the money that was created in 2008 to bail out the banks. Because they do this thing of saying, the CPI hasn't gone over anything normal, there hasn't been any inflation. But, just ask anyone, is your life cheaper or more expensive since 2008? It's much more expensive. It happened more slowly than the last 5 years. But, Gordon Brown was credited with saving the world because he arranged some big, organized some big meeting where they all agreed to all bail out at once. Because otherwise you get beggar thy neighbor type policies, The lesson of the 1930s and 20s was, if we all inflate together, then all of the governments stay standing, and don't undermine themselves. That's like Gordon Brown's been given credit for that ever since. It's absolutely ridiculous. Like Curtis says, all they did, was just throw more money into the system, and that did keep it going at the time. But the price for that is still to come due, and I think that will come due in the next few years, and there will be the big one. And the banking system really will fall down forever. God knows what follows that. Yeah.
And faced by disaster in Afghanistan, the politicians did exactly the same there too. The Americans knew that the idea of democracy was failing. In desperation, they poured even more money into the Afghan economy. The idea was that this would somehow create a simpler economic form of democracy, and that the free market would liberate people. They would become model...
There you go.
He's just shut... It is such a shit ideology, liberal democracy. It's and just crap in all ways.
Well, it is It's like the genie in the bottle. It's the fairy story. And with one bound, Jack was free.
And it's the same mistake as Bin Laden and al-Zawahiri made, which is like everyone agrees with us, they're just being held back.
Consumers, following their own rational self-interest, just like in the economies of the West. And in an odd way, it worked. Many of those in charge of the money did behave in their own rational self-interest. They simply stole the money, smuggled it out through Kabul Airport, and used it to buy luxury properties in Dubai. During this period, it was estimated that $10 million a day was being taken out of Afghanistan this way. The scandal seemed to confirm for many Afghans that the United States had not brought democracy or free markets to their country, but instead a corrupt crony capitalism that had taken over Afghanistan and its government. Which was
just like in the West, eh?
The very same allegation that was being made against politicians at home, in America and in Britain. At the end of 2014, British soldiers left Afghanistan. All the bases were wiped out, as if nothing had been there.
This is why, by the way, in the recent stats I did, Britain got a D draw in Afghanistan and America got an L, because of the timing of the withdrawal.
Even the war memorials were packed up and taken back to Staffordshire. They weren't the only fighters who had left Afghanistan. Abu Musab al-Zarqawi had gone to Afghanistan to fight the Soviets back in the 1980s. Then he had stayed on to work with Osama bin Laden. And in 2003, he went to Iraq and set up a jihadist group called Al-Qaeda in Iraq to fight the American invasion. Al-Zarqawi was powerfully influenced by bin Laden's ideas, but he took them much further. He and his group killed anyone who they decided did not believe in their fundamentalist ideas and deserved to die. Even the original founders of Al-Qaeda were shocked, and they sent him a letter telling him to stop killing civilians. But Al-Zarqawi ignored them. He was convinced that the insurgency in Iraq could be used to spread an Islamist revolution throughout the Arab world. But before he could do this, the Americans found Al-Zarqawi and dropped a large bomb on him. But it didn't stop the spread of the idea. Despite Al-Zarqawi's death, his organization survived and began to mutate into something even more ferocious and ambitious. But as it did so, it was possessed by ghosts from the past. What reemerged was the fierce, intolerant vision of Wahhabism that had survived from the 1920s. It had spread outwards through Afghanistan in the 1980s and 90s, where it had become mixed with modern Islamist ideas. But now, faced by the nihilistic horror of post-invasion Iraq, any idea of building a new revolutionary future disappeared. And instead, the conservative and backward-looking Wahhabism became the dominating influence, with its desire to retreat to an imagined past. In 2013, the Islamic State of Iraq and the Levant was formed, known as ISIS in the West. Its aim is to create a unified caliphate throughout the Islamic world. And although it uses the techniques of modern media, it is at heart the same violent dream that had driven the Bedouins who had created the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia in the 1920s. Back then, the King of Saudi Arabia had found it necessary to try and exterminate them, because they too wanted to go on and conquer the whole of the Islamic world. He machine-gunned them in the bleak sands of the Arabian Peninsula. And now, the Saudis, along with the British and the Americans, are trying to do the same thing again, to kill the jihadists and their ideas in the sand dunes of northern Iraq and Syria. But it is an uncertain war. Western politicians are having to accept that the simple division between good and evil doesn't exist. By bombing ISIS, they are helping the evil President Assad to remain in power. And those in charge don't even know how big a threat ISIS really is. Is it a dark existential threat? Or is it really a front being used in an ongoing complex power struggle inside Iraq? We just don't know. At the end of the Soviet science fiction film, Solaris, the astronaut returns home. Everything seems real and normal, but somehow he doesn't trust in anything any longer. Although we have returned from Afghanistan, our leaders also seem to have lost faith in anything. And the simple stories they tell us don't make sense any longer. Experience of Afghanistan has made us begin to realize that there is something else out there, but we just don't have the apparatus to see it. What is needed is a new story, and one that we can believe in.
finally, the film has finished. It took us 4 episodes, the longest, because it was a complete... What, like, he didn't split it up into parts this time. This was 2.5 hours long. And just, I mean, that neither of those things are there anymore. Is that right? That ISIS, that Islamic State that they set up in Iraq is gone. And Assad is gone, is that right?
Yeah.
He must have made this just as ISIS broke out in Iraq, right? But maybe hadn't yet got involved in Syria. I think he must have made this at that time.
And now they're both gone, I think.
Yep.
Yeah. And obviously, like he says that, like he emphasizes that the West was trying to wipe out jihadists, like even Saud had done, or whoever it was. But obviously, the West also went on to support the Al Qaeda faction in Syria, right? And they are the people who are now, is it Jilani? They're now in charge, right? With the support of the West, pretty much. And like he's been reinvented in the Western press and stuff. So there's so much complexity there about actually like destroying and supporting jihadists in all sorts of situations.
Yeah, yeah. The interesting thing about the way he uses Solaris there, the ending of the film Solaris, is the astronaut thinks he's returned home. But the problem is the planet Solaris is this sort of thing that captures memories and dreams and then recreates your reality. And the idea he's, you know, hammering there is that we have been absorbed into these kind of fictional projections of these nations based on our own failed ideas. And here's a bit from our favourite left-wing intellectual John Gray. He says, in Bitter Lake, a documentary by filmmaker Adam Curtis, a short clip illustrates how this cultural mission was conducted. The footage shows Afghan men and women in a darkened seminar room, sitting in the dim light given off by a projected image of Marcel Duchamp's celebrated urinal, listening to a lecture given by a young Englishwoman with a faint Rodin-like accent on the work's significance. When the lecturer says she does not expect the females in the audience to recognize the object in question, the camera pans away from her to show their reaction. Glancing nervously at one another, the women seem baffled. One shakes her head incredulously. Most of those present seem perplexed, not so much as to the function of the object, as by the purpose of the lecture. Unfazed, the lecturer assures the audience that the work was a revolutionary act. In later footage, she goes on to assert that Duchamp's aim was to fight against the system. The notion that Afghanistan needed to embrace Duchamp's art may seem comically absurd, yet it has a hidden logic. The Franco-American painter and creator of ready-mades, everyday objects that have been slightly tweaked and designated as works of art, followed early 20th century Dadaism, in aiming to deconstruct art itself. Signed and dated R. Mutt, 1917, the urinal signified that art would not in future be shaped by any practice or tradition, no longer a distinct sphere of human activity with its own ruling norms. It would be whatever anyone wanted it to be. Duchamp inaugurated an assertion of unfettered human autonomy that has come to pervade ethics and politics. If the liberal West stands for anything more, this is it.
Very interesting. There are a few super chats that we should deal with. Milo Clancy says, I have just finished Shifty. That's the new one, right? That's the new Adam Curtis.
Yeah.
And what struck me are the similarities to your Ashes of Civilization series. Curtis is coming from the left, but also confronts the audience with decline. Ultimately, Boris will not like episode 4. Costanza says, who has contact with Adam Curtis? Let's make this huge. The biggest collab on kayfabe. Make it happen. Tragic Vision says, I like how the first 20 minutes has just become a compressed version of Unpopular Opinions every week. No. It's not the same at all. Very different.
I thought maybe I was a bit out of line last week because I just used the first part of last week's program to give my response to one of your videos, and it is, after all, your channel. I wonder if that was a bit much, if you didn't mind.
No, it's fine, yeah. No, I think people liked the banter at the start, but okay. Ian S. says, I wish Curtis still voiced his new documentaries. Cheers, lad. Is he not voicing Shifty?
No, it's all done with his famous on-screen Helvetica captions. But it's easy enough to follow. And there really is really great archive that he's picked up in there. Some stuff he's reused from other documentaries to make points when it's relevant, but a lot of it is some really funny stuff and some quite dark stuff as it goes on as well towards the end.
Yeah. I mean, I should say that Ashes of Civilization, if you people haven't seen it, which is just a kind of collage edit thing, was heavily inspired by Adam Curtis in the first place. So the similarities are because literally Ashes of Civilization was my faux, was my own kind of Curtis efforts, if that makes any sense. So James Murr says, any idea what Trump's Truth Social last night means? Two new flags being raised at the White House, 11 a.m. Washington time today. Flags of war? Flags for war? I don't know. I don't know what the... I have no idea. Anyone got any... anyone seen that?
Nope.
I don't think anybody knows what Trump is doing at the moment. Chris Primer says, can you legally study the blade in the UK these days?
As long as it's a butter knife, I guess.
I think Keir Starmer banned ninja swords, didn't he, or something? Chris said, well, funny enough, I have a sword here and the handle is kind of the thread has come out. So I was, after this finishes, I'm going to have to go to B&Q and see if I can find that guy. Be like, can you help me fix this, please? I don't know what to do with it otherwise. You can't really go and see like a blacksmith or something, can you? Chris says, thanks for this stream to offer research material. Next, Curtis, is films of Jiang King. That's with a Q. For research material, I've uploaded King title Blood on Wolf Mountain from 1936. English subtitles, full film, unavailable everywhere, says Chris. Not Kagwa says, a warm place from Nine Inch Nails was least expected in this. I would say, yet again, the use of Nine Inch Nails is always expected.
Hugely expected.
In Adam Curtis.
Yeah.
I mean, the only thing perhaps more expected would be Burial, or who are some of his other goes to? Brian Eno, basically.
Yeah, yeah.
John Carpenter.
And John Carpenter, yeah, John Carpenter, yep. Yeah.
Yeah.
Coney says, number one, remember the footage of the Soviet primary teacher teaching young Afghan children last week? The Soviets had done it to the Uzbeks, Tajiks, Turkmen. It's understandable why they thought they could secularize the Afghans with modern education. Contrast that to the British teacher trying to teach Dadaist art to teenage Afghan girls. The attempt comes across as so ridiculously farcical, but also pernicious, liberalism being a moral syphilis. Yeah, and I couldn't help but think when we got that brief image of the pudgy face of David Cameron at the end there. What a facile, empty kind of worldview he has. The David Cameron basically epitomizes everything that Curtis is saying, of kind of a, like somebody who just believes nothing, basically.
Cameron took it upon himself to try and make it normal to call ISIS Daesh because it didn't contain any reference to Islam.
You just wonder, can't these people see themselves? Can't they hear themselves?
This is what comes of excluding from your life and from your social circles anyone who disagrees with you, anyone who harshes the buzz of your own opinions. I think.
Piotr says, silver lining, should a ground invasion of Iran happen, not that things ever happen, Curtis will have new material to work with.
Yeah.
I honestly think that if Adam Curtis, I mean, okay, if he makes his kayfabe thing, that'd be interesting. But I think that a documentary on what we've witnessed this past week, how MAGA was co-opted by the iron law of oligarchy, how MAGA went from being a populist revolt against the system to being literally just the system again. I think that would make a fantastic documentary. Whether Curtis would be the one to make it or not, I don't know, but I imagine he'd have great material to work with archivally.
Well, he's
all the rallies. And...
I mean, he's having to fight hard against some of the stuff that's coming out this week, isn't he? You know, what people playing saxophones at parties in with missiles raining.
I know. Well, I put together my own little Adam Curtis.
Do
you want to see it?
Go on. You can never have too much Floyd Kramer.
Let's have a look. Here was my own Adam Curtis remix. I called it Adam Curtis Remix of the Iran versus Israel conflict to date.
Biggest sack of popcorn I've ever seen.
Yeah, so Curtis couldn't have Pepsi material to work with.
You could insert a couple of like interstitial shots of Netanyahu preparing for one of his shit talks or whatever.
Yeah, exactly. Or
some Trump boomers dancing
off mic, or I don't know, Lindsey Graham about to go on Fox News, or something like that.
Mark Levin blowing his nose.
Yeah, well, I mean, if people hadn't seen all of our previous review. I can't remember what documentary it's from now, but Curtis uses that music over, I think it's like a civil war in Congo.
It was a machete fight in a refugee camp. The Hutus and the Tutsis in All Watched Over by Machines of Loving Grace. I coined it machete jazz. It's Floyd Kramer's On the Rebound.
And I had a little spate of making Adam Curtis remix of famous videos and things.
Incredibly violent scenes accompanied by a sort of jaunty kind of
that scene in Goodfellas where they're kicking the shit out of the guy, you know.
You made that one, right? But that was inspired by a real one from the other day, wasn't it?
Well, all of those. So the first one was the guy playing the saxophone. That happened. That was in Lebanon, and the missiles were from Iran going to Israel. Then the popcorn that you saw, that was in Tehran. As Tehran was being bombed by the Israelis, they decided to just watch it with popcorn.
Wow.
And then the one of the DJ, that was at a wedding that was taking place in Lebanon. And again, it was the Iranian hypersonics heading towards Israel. So, yeah.
Come to think of it, though, if I was around a friend's house in, I don't know, like Bounds Green or something, and I was somewhere high up, like Alexandra Palace, and I was looking down and I was seeing Westminster get struck by, you know, I don't know who would strike Westminster, but I might get the saxophone and the popcorn out as well. Maybe.
Well, what else are you going to do? Let's face it. I mean, you know, basically like a really dangerous firework display, I guess, from a certain point of view. Just before we go, do you know I've been watching that Limmy of late. I've learned some Limmy deep lore, and one of the things I've learned is that a few years ago, Limmy wrote an autobiography, and it was given a scathing review on Radio 4 by a chap called Lloyd Cole, who's a singer. He's called
Lloyd band, Cole of the Commotions.
Yeah, that Lloyd Cole, who I actually played on AA Radio once. And if you remember, I said he looks a bit like Millennial Woes. In fact, let me show you a picture of Lloyd Cole. I mean, I don't think I'm like I do think that he bears more than a passing resemblance to Woes.
Oh, yeah.
And I told Woes this before, unrelated to Limmy. Right. Well, anyway, Lloyd Cole and these couple of other people on Radio 4 gave this really snobbish, snooty kind of review of Linney's book, where Lloyd Cole says things like, oh, you know, and it's written with a kind of intelligence and things like this. They're really kind of dismissive of his book. And Linney took it really, really badly, like really badly, and did like a very angry, emotional, ranty kind of response to it. And it became like a thing. It became like a Linney and Lloyd Cole of the Commotions, like had beef, like they had online beef. And this was an ongoing saga and there were back and forths and, you know, and so I've been kind of like going through this saga that happened 4 or 5 years ago. Because it just keeps on coming up on my timeline. I was like, oh, here's another Linney video. I'll watch. So I'm discovering there's Linney Deep Lore, where, yeah, he takes a review of his book really, really badly. But I thought that I mentioned it because it's kind of a weird... If people are looking for other things other than impending World Doom and World War III to focus on, you could do worse than have a look at unexpected Lloyd Cole Linney beef.
Wow. So give some love to Linney, maybe.
I it turns out the guy's got some, may have some like psychological issues. I'll just say that. Linney may have some demons, you know. But, anyway.
Oh, well.
What about Bitter Lake in the overall Curtis pantheon before we wrap up on this?
It's difficult to tell from what we've done. I mean, as I say, I regret kind of us having to stop it. It's one of those ones you just got to kind of sit through and bathe in, and I think it's actually very powerful, but it's one that you have to sort of absorb without interruptions, such as we're giving. I think it's extremely strong, this stuff that he does when he moves towards iPlayer instead of just having it, you know, put out on BBC Two. You know, I find there were moments of fantastic beauty in there. I mean, I want to just quickly read this out. This is a note sent to me by a watcher, Mr. Skinner, who was talking about the sequence last week where you had the little Hazara guy doing the kind of Jackie Chan routine, and you had the Taliban fighters. And Mr. Skinner says, why is Curtis soundtracking footage of an Afghan playfully practicing martial arts and Taliban fighters giving an impassioned blood and soil speech against Western invaders with Kanye West? The track Runaway from My Beautiful Dark Twisted Fantasy is the bleeding heart of the album, the beautiful among the dark and twisted. Following the MTV Video Awards debacle, where he interrupted Taylor Swift receiving her prize, West was roundly trashed by the media, and even President Obama gave his 2 cents, labeling Ye a jackass. In this track, Kanye expresses and affirms his humanity, warts and all, in defiance of those who have closed ranks around him in an effort to suppress his persona and expression. The outro of the track features a vocal solo through layers of distortion, the words indiscernible, but the effect being a mimic of a guitar solo, but imbued with the emotion of the human voice. Where this complements the footage is in Curtis's contrasting the popular perception of the Afghan people as towel heads, durka durka, etc., with these moments of sincere humanity. Their words are also not discernible to us. Curtis is picking up on some spark they have within, which he is looking to elevate. The list of empires that AA reeled off that met their match when facing these people only serves to reinforce this point. Curtis is imbuing these people with a heart. I think that expresses well, actually, what a lot of Bitter Lake does. This sort of, you get a sense that they're sort of quite a, you know, a gentle people, the Afghans, completely baffled by what we're doing, and obviously if they need to kick back they can do it perfectly adequately, but you don't sense it's the kind of heart of their people. They're not a sort of a cruel warlord people in a sense. They just want to be left alone, and I think that's the sort of takeaway feeling.
They certainly don't seem like the types who want to control even their region, let alone anything beyond. Some people do, some people don't. They seem like more quietist in that sense. Like, extremely religious, obviously, like, profoundly religious, but not a danger to their neighbours.
I mean, when we talked about, I talked briefly in one of the episodes about, you know, the IEDs, you know, the British soldiers getting affected by improvised explosive devices and things, there was quite an internal debate within the Taliban about the ethics of using things like that, because they were aware that they could also hurt the civilian population. So they're sort of quite deeply principled conversations about how to fight wars that were going on as well.
And there's some parallels with Vietnam, isn't there? Obviously, there's obvious ones, but also in the sense that, you know, that Vietnam, it's hard to imagine it as a threat to the rest of the world. I mean,
yeah.
The idea was always the domino theory, but never proven. You can't prove it because you'd have to let it play out to see whether it really happened or not. But Vietnam was like a really sort of, you think of it as like a modest country, you know, small place with limited horizons in a way. And suddenly it's, you know, somehow it's turned into an enemy that we must combat and defeat. You know, the same thing was done with Afghanistan. Always seemed absurd as well. They're like the threatening figure of bin Laden, you know, was enough to scare some people. But the Taliban, much as they sounded horrible, you know, blowing up the Buddhas and all sorts of stuff, they didn't seem threatening. And yet these, you know, the war pigs managed to make us go along with it.
Last minute super chat from Begbie, who says, that was dark. How can they possibly believe they can regime change Iran? Do you think we will see boots on the ground?
Just about that, you mentioned that during the program, and like, if I assume Trump is going through like the biggest dilemma of his life right now, because like all his donors, all the people he's foolishly surrounded himself with, his daughter, his son-in-law, and loads of other people are all berating him, like, why have you not, you know, attacked Iran already? But he does know that it's not likely to achieve anything good. It might bring down the existing regime. It's by no means any guarantee of a good one replacing it. Or, you know, I'm sure Israel will say they've got people in place ready to take over. But it probably won't. It probably won't work. And obviously a large part, I don't know how many sincerely of the MAGA base are against it, but they're not. Like, the MAGA people are not ardent Zionists by and large. I don't know. I mean, their speakers are, you know, their influencers are. But I think this is desperation by Israel. Like this isn't really going to help them over 20 years. It's going to pump up their morale over 20 days. But Iran is huge, and the people there are pretty smart, and it's quite developed. They've got serious military forces. They've got a lot of problems as well. But to take over Iran, to determine the fate of Iran, that's a fantasy. That's madness.
Well, the Ayatollah has just led off a tweet storm, as he's wont to do. Do you want to know what he said?
Go on.
He says, the US president threatens us with his absurd rhetoric. He demands that the Iranian people surrender to him. They should make threats against those who are afraid of being threatened. The Iranian nation is not frightened by such threats. It isn't wise to tell the Iranian nation to surrender. What should the Iranian nation surrender to? We will never surrender in response to the attacks of anyone. This is the logic of the Iranian nation. This is the spirit of the Iranian nation. The US entering in this matter, brackets war, is 100% to its own detriment. The damage it will suffer will be far greater than any harm that Iran may encounter. The harm the US military will suffer will definitely be irreparable if they enter this conflict. The Zionist regime's malicious attack on our country took place at a time when Iranian initials were indirectly engaged in negotiations with the US side. There was no indication on the part of Iran that signaled a military move. And then he goes on and on. And then he just says, the Zionist enemy has made a grave mistake and committed a serious crime, and it must be punished. So they're not going to back that. Like I said, they're not going to back down. They're not going to.
They've been threatened for 40 years now.
Yeah, they're just ready. Not going to.
So we don't think they're going to send in the military anthropologists then?
Yeah, it's hard to know. It's a rock and a hard place. Like I said on my coverage yesterday, it's the immovable object against the irresistible force. And it's hard to know what's going to give at the minute. But boots on the ground will be long, grisly, and basically a war that the Americans are not. I don't know if you guys saw that parade the other day. I think it's shit. Yeah. This is going to be
it's
the
like
invasion.
A parody.
Oh, it's just. I kind of avoided it. I managed not to see it over the weekend, but I was watching something where they were showing clips of the parade. I was like, bloody hell. Yeah. It was embarrassing. I mean, you know, even our parades are better than that.
It's Al Pacino in Godfather 3. Just when I try to get out of the forever wars, they pull me back in.
So, anyway. I will. Anything that you guys want to promote before we get out of here?
I'm on Twitter at Simon_Roberts. I may suggest to AA that we do a little backtrack before we go on to hypernormalization and do one of the little short documentaries that we missed out on. But we'll see how that pans out.
Oh, it's hypernormalization next, is it?
It would be, but I think we've missed out Every Day Is Like Sunday about Press Baron, Cecil King. It's only a short one from that kind of 80s period.
I want to promote Simon's Twitter as well. If you follow Simon on Twitter, you get like extra content related to these streams, which you might not have seen otherwise.
It's like Simon, an appendix, really, isn't it, to the show?
Thank you very much.
Yeah. It's like the red button, or you know, and like there's various good people like Shembros and others who contribute stuff, like tagging Simon and me and AA, and you see a lot of that Simon's feed. So go follow him on Twitter.
Thanks very much.
I'll just remind people, promo code Scorcher, buy it now. And I've decided I am not sticking around for the heat wave. 33 degrees here on Saturday, on Friday and Saturday.
Whoa.
So I have decided that I'm going to flee to Wales for the weekend. I've informed my parents, I am not staying here. I'm going to go to the fresh, cool, salty air of back home, where it's due to be something like 21 degrees in Wales for the weekend. So I'm buggering off. I can't stand the heat. Anyway, pick up a course and I'll see you soon.
What goes on in this town is none of your business.
As long as I'm living here, it is.
Then maybe you shouldn't be living here!
Well, that's easily fixed.